Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff back after our first week off from the new year, which was mainly due to me having a cold.
Yeah.
But also due to a lot of other stuff going on in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And with us, and yeah, just yeah. Things happening.
Yes.
So yeah, we are back today, though. We are going to be talking about Black Panther, the Marvel sensation that's gripping the nation.
That is the way to phrase it, I think, yes.
It sounds cheesy, but it's 100% true.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
We'll get to our spoiler-free review on that in a second. We're going to talk about some news. Yes, we'll talk about the Han Solo trailer, you know, stupid shit like that. We're going to talk about stupid shit like I've been playing the hell out of Dragon Quest Builders on the Nintendo
sure,
Switch. We're
going
to talk about that.
Game.
So we're just going to have fun today with a lot of cool stuff to talk about, right?
Yeah.
But I want to start because we've been off for 2 weeks, and in those 2 weeks... In this last week, something happened that, I don't know, it's been such a part of my mind and consciousness in the last couple days that I would feel remiss not to mention it, and that is the school shooting that happened in Florida at the high school, and the many, obviously, complex and tragic emotions that come from that. The sense of helplessness that this keeps happening over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And we have to keep watching this happen. And for me, I think the specific reaction of seeing it happen once again at a school and once again to children, in this case, teenagers. And, you know, I professionally have for like 6 years now been tutoring high schoolers and teaching, and you are getting your teaching license,
yeah.
And you work with high schoolers, and, you know, I just, when these things happen, what goes through my mind is all the great, amazing kids I've met doing what I do, and the number, and because they're all amazing in a different way.
Right.
Is the thing I think you get to realize when you teach on kind of any level.
Mm-hmm.
They're all, you know, they're people. They're real people. They're not numbers and they're not statistics, and they matter. And we lived through some of this in that, obviously, you and I aren't that much older than these kids. We lived through having to do shooting drills and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also remember when Columbine was fresh.
Yeah.
And it maintained a grip on the news, and it was part of a cultural conversation for years.
And it was something specifically because, you know, we were kids when it happened and, like, growing up in Colorado.
Yeah.
Like, post-Columbine for, like, basically our whole school life. Like, that cast such a huge shadow. And school shootings still happened, but it was not with... There's nowhere near the frequency that it happens right now.
And it felt like it had... You know, we felt the world changing and it wasn't taken for granted. And
yeah.
There's this horrible thing in our culture now that people have to... in their lives, in the shooting drills and the horrible mundanity of this, in that it happens so much, it's like we take it for granted to some degree. And that fills me with dread and horror. But I also wanted to say that I feel more hopeful right now about the future of getting past this than I ever have after another one of these recent mass shootings, because of the kids who survived this and have not been silent.
Yeah.
And that, I think, means more to the world and to this country than we can fathom, because we are fucking a generation in not doing anything. And I don't care if your solution... If you think the solution isn't gun control, suggest a solution.
Yeah.
That's all I want to hear. What's your solution? Because we have actual policies.
Yeah.
I want to hear what your solution... Honestly, because that's a conversation, is you come to the table with a different solution. But there needs to be a solution. And the generation we have raised, we have abandoned to this, is not standing for it. And they are vocally not standing for it. And they are so much more together and profound. And I'm struggling to find the words. Just eloquent on this issue then I can't believe you can be that eloquent and powerful on an issue like this after surviving something like that.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people right now doing that and using social media and the power they wield to say important things, and that, I think, is an important thing right now.
Yeah,
and it means the world.
It's something of that it is. It feels different this time in terms of the reaction and the, as you said, the students are getting their message out there and their voice out there. And it does feel like people are paying attention. Like, I desperately hope that this time there will be enough of something. Like, it's not going to be immediate, but hopefully the next election go around, if we can get different people in Congress and maybe finally have some fucking legislation, like one piece of legislation passed, at least trying to address it. Whether it's gun control, whether it's people who, you know, are desperately holding on to that guns are not the issue somehow, despite all evidence, and then always put up the bullshit of like, well, it's actually, we need to, like, it's a mental health problem, but they never actually fucking do anything about mental health either. It's like, do something. Do fucking something. And it's like, it's such a criminally low bar to ask of our government to do one fucking thing to try to stymie the incredible flood of mass shootings in this country, most tragically in schools but everywhere.
Yeah.
like just do one fucking thing,
because
hopefully this can be a spark that causes one piece of legislation, at least get our fucking foot in the door, right?
Because this one is particularly bald-faced in its obviousness,
yeah.
In that the kid who committed this atrocity, every red flag in the world that a person could have, other than having previously committed a mass shooting and somehow getting away with it, other than that, every red flag a person could possibly have, this kid had.
Yeah.
And he still bought an AR-15 and a fuck ton of ammunition legally.
Yeah.
Without any repercussions. And that's insane.
Yeah, there's no legitimate reason for a citizen to have access to a military-grade weapon. Like, there's no reason at all. There's no possible hypothetical reason. There's no, you're not using a fucking assault rifle to go hunting, you know? Like, it's...
Or at the very least, maybe don't sell them to obviously dangerous people who have been reported to the FBI.
Yes.
Just like,
exactly, like the bar,
lowest bar.
The bar is so low, because the bar should be, hey, don't sell it to anyone unless there's like a really specific special reason why they need this weapon, they're a member of the military, whatever. Like, there might be something. But it's like, the bar should be, like 99.9% of the population does not have access to a fucking military-grade assault rifle, and then that's like where you start. It shouldn't be everybody can get it. And then we start eliminating people from that list. That's the insane way to go about it.
Yeah, and you know, if you don't agree, I thank you for listening through our soapbox moment.
Yeah.
But it is truly, I struggle to be silent on this anymore, because I think it's immoral to not be silent with whatever you think the solution is, because it's truly a pandemic.
Yeah, it's something of that every other country does not have this problem. It's only America that has this specific issue with mass shootings.
Yeah. And again, whatever you think the solution might be, I do think it's incumbent to say that, whatever you think it is. And just seeing, again, bringing it back to the sheer bravery and, again, eloquence of the teenagers who survived this and have gone on to try to make a genuine difference in the name of the friends they lost. I can't even begin to imagine. And I guess I would just say our silly, stupid podcast goes out to all of them today.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Let's move on and talk about silly, stupid shit, which we will.
Okay, that's what we're best at.
At least Black Panther exists in the perfect, like, middle space between silly, stupid shit and, like, genuinely meaningful for the world shit.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, like, or for our culture, at least. So that's going to be great.
It hits our sweet spot.
It really does. But for now, Sean, let's talk stuff.
Okay.
The other reason I am exhausted beyond all belief is that I moved houses in the last week.
Right.
And all my stuff is currently in boxes. And I'd been leaving the microphone for this podcast in my car just so I wouldn't lose it. And pretty much what I have access to in my life is on the table in front of us right now, or in my bag next to me. So, yeah. So I'm a little exhausted from all of that, having a cold in the middle of that. Not fun. But, Sean, what have you been up to?
You know, stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah. I've been Because what? The last time? Because I'd finished Digimon Story by the last podcast.
Yes,
it's been 2 weeks. I have to remember where my life was 2 weeks ago. You know, time moves so fucking fast these days. I have continued to play Dragon Ball FighterZ. I beat the story mode, which I don't think I had done last time. I have really conflicted feelings about the story mode in that game. It's something of that a lot of the writing and the performances and stuff I really enjoy. And I wish that it was more focused to deliver that stuff, because at some point it feels like they just have to drag things out to put fights in the middle. And it's just like, I kind of wish that they had separated it into two different modes. One which was have some fights, obviously, but like be more of a vehicle to deliver like the you know, the character stuff and the jokes and the fan service and all of that. And then another mode that is like a more elaborate, kind of like the Persona 4 Arena Ultimax had a Golden Arena mode, I think it was called, that had some of this stuff that's like a more elaborate version of like an arcade ladder that has some like you will kind of like level up your characters in between and get different modifiers and stuff. I kind of wish that they had broken those two pieces out ultimately, because while I enjoyed my time through the story mode and I think it's worth playing, I do think you should skip most of the fights. Unless like you are very specifically like, I'm going to just keep on trying this combo and treat it like a glorified training mode. Unless you're doing that, I think it's like look up the list of the different like combinations you need to do to get the special like pre-fight scenes and just work it and like move through the story quickly, because it just drags too much. And it's more fun to play the arcade mode where the fights are really streamlined and focused and you get into them right away and the difficulty is at a good space, or to play online multiplayer. So that's sort of like my brief thing on the story mode for that. But other than that, like I think the fighting in that game is utterly fantastic. I am still having a lot of fun playing that. I've done like all the combos, like training things they do. It's just something that a lot of fighting games do, but where you go in and they kind of give you some basic preset combos for each of the characters in the whole roster that you can go through to kind of get a sense of, all right, this is how you play Vegeta that's not just mashing on one of the buttons and mashing out one of the auto combos. You get a sense of the different characters having like, okay, Vegeta, like one of Vegeta's main things is if you want to combo with him, you kind of interrupt his different special attacks that have multiple hits. And so you can kind of chain them together in different ways if you know when to stop them in the middle of an attack. And so you get a better sense of doing those combo challenges of what each of the characters are like. And then after doing that, I've started playing some online. I'm not very good at the game, but it is. But I'm having a lot more fun playing this than I have had any fighting game in recent memory, since like playing Marvel vs. Capcom 2 or something like that.
I think, I forget which podcast it was after, but a couple weeks ago we were podcasting, we finished, and we were like, hey, that didn't take 5.5 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
And we were like, and you were like, want to play some Dragon Ball? And I'm like, sure. And we just sat on your couch and played Dragon Ball FighterZ for a while. I don't think I ever beat you once that night. It was still so much fun, because that is one of those, and this is, I think, a key thing for fighting games. It's true of any of the, like, greats that, like, a broad audience loves, like a Smash Bros. Or something as well, that even if you are getting your ass handed to you, it's just fun, like that crazy intangible thing we try to talk about in games called fun.
Yeah.
And it just has that, and some of it is the style, and some of it is the tone, and some of it is just the accessibility and the feeling that you're not, even if you're getting your ass handed to you, you're not completely powerless, but it is just fun, and that is an important thing, because I agree, like, I have not played Dragon Ball FighterZ in a couple weeks because my PS4 is in a box.
Right.
And there's no portable version
of it for
me right
now. That's a pretty good excuse.
Yes. But I cannot wait to play more of it, and I really do love the little time I've played online or competitively with you or with my brother or something. It is just, it's a party game. It's great on that level, you know? If you had a bunch of people over, that would be a great thing to just pass the controller around playing.
Yeah, and it is especially, like, for people who are fans of Dragon Ball, there's so much stuff in there that, like, that was some of the most fun I had playing it with you. It was just going through, like, all the different ridiculous moves, particularly for the characters like Nappa or Captain Ginyu or Frieza that just have some really stupid shit that they can do. Like, Nappa can plant Cybermen that, like, jump out and explode on you and all that stuff.
I think today, when we're recording this on a Saturday, which is a little earlier than we usually do it, but I think I'd read today that we got official confirmation of the first two DLC characters, and they are Bardock and Broly, which is, I think those are going to be fun. Like, Broly's not a great character, but he's great for fighting games.
Yeah, that's exactly my feeling on it. It's like, I don't give a shit about Broly in, like, I do not ever want to see Broly in a movie or a Dragon Ball Super or anything like that, but I will definitely play him and, like, pick people up and smash them into the ground.
Yes, but I was thinking about this, like, maybe I need to go back and, like, watch the Broly movies again so I'll know all the crazy references they've got in there.
Yes.
Because there's no... I know the first one pretty well because I saw it a lot as a kid, even though it's the longest, most boring, shitty Dragon Ball movie. But, like, the second and third ones, I don't remember nearly as well. Other than the moments in the second one that are just a ripoff of the Cell Games fight.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're going to pull a lot of reference from the third one where Broly is, like, a sentient, like, fleshy sludge.
I mean, you say that, there could very easily be, like, a mode where, like, you know, go down quarter circle R1, and, like, he turns into Sludge Broly, and then you have a different set of moves. Yeah,
I would love it. I mean, I know it's not because the magazine scans, which is how we know the characters have, like, detailed basically what their special moves are, and so I know that it's his sort of gigantic meteor attack that is usually what his move is in most video games. I desperately hope that somehow they put in another version of Broly that his ultimate level 3 attack is he just turns into Bio Broly. It's just like, I don't know what attack, like he just floods the screen and pushes you to another map or something, because it's movie is so bad. It's the most non-Dragon Ball thing you could possibly make.
I think it's got the least Goku in it of, like, any Dragon Ball thing, other than some, like, filler episodes, because he's in the beginning and the end as a ghost.
Yeah, I mean,
it's all Goten and Trunks.
Yeah, it's Goten, Trunks, and a little bit of Android 18 and Krillin. Like, those are the main characters of that movie.
Oh, you know what? That does have Mr. Satan and Android 18's thing going on, and I like that.
That's the only good part of the movie.
But I was going to say, like, I remember Broly. We're way off track, but it's fun. Broly in Super Sonic Warriors 2 for the DS, which is another of the Arc System Works games. I loved playing as Broly in that one because of how they did his, like, meteor smash attack where he would just grab... I remember, like, specifically, I can see it in my head right now, him, like, grabbing Krillin's head and smashing him into the ground and, like... Seeing that on PS4 is going to be great.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, this game's awesome. Anything else to say about that?
No, that's just, it's a good fucking game.
From one Akira Toriyama designed game to another.
Okay, yeah.
I've been playing the ever living shit out of Dragon Quest Builders on Nintendo Switch.
Great.
This game is so good, and I have the case for the game with me right now because I just have to look at it while I'm talking about it because. I will admit, like 90% of the reason I bought this on Switch, despite being in the middle of playing Digimon, is this has maybe one of the very best video game covers I have ever seen.
It's very good.
It's very good. We're looking at it right now. I assume that's just a Toriyama original illustration, because he still does stuff like that from time to time. Like with the original Dragon Quest games on like the Famicom and stuff, he obviously drew all the covers for those. He still would for the new games as well. Yeah. But I think because Dragon Quest Builders on PS4 just had like it's a CGI screenshot kind of thing. This is like a hand drawn. It is a Toriyama illustration. You've got the main builder character with a big block, and behind him just all the different like characters and character types in the game in that just delightful Toriyama art style that is. So singular and so identifiable. And I was just like, I need that box in my life, and I hope the game inside of it is good too. Dragon Quest Builders obviously came out for the PS4 in 2016, right?
Yeah, because we talked about it when the beta like demo came out.
That was one of the early entries in Sean's Beta Corner.
Yes.
Yes. But I had never... I'd played the beta on PS4, but I had never played the full game even though I wanted to. And it was just... There was something about looking at this game, like the videos for it on Switch and reading about it, and like my life being hectic and everything. I was like, that's what I need. I don't know why. Sometimes games just call to you. I think that happened to you with Hatsune Miku.
Yes, no. That's also what happened to me with Digimon in many ways.
Absolutely. And I've been playing it ever since. I've put Digimon on hold. I actually got to a point in the story that was kind of a good put it aside for a second. I cannot wait to get back. It's a great game. But Dragon Quest Builders on the Nintendo Switch, it's pretty much exactly like it is on the PS4 and Xbox. Or it's not on Xbox One. On the PS4. But a perfect Switch game. One of the more seamless Switch games in terms of like the handheld mode to the big screen mode. Where like, I don't know. It looks like the exact same game to me. And I know from, like, a Digital Foundry analysis that on handheld it runs at, like, 30 FPS, not 60, and on docked it runs at 60. You can't tell with this game, in part because it's not a game that needs 60.
Right, yeah, like, your perspective is so pulled back and stuff.
But it's still just, it's so stable and smooth, you don't notice or care about it at all. Dragon Quest Builders is, like, no shit, an amazing, amazing, masterful, I think truly innovative game. It is one of... the most original and creative games of this generation, despite being an obvious Minecraft clone in some ways.
Yeah, it feels like it's it feels like this weird thing that we never really got, that it felt like we were going to get a lot of, which is a lot of games inspired by Minecraft that like go with it the way that, you know, happened with first person shooters or cover shooters, like where a big genre hits and then like it sort of like infects everything. It's like, okay, like we'll like do our take on Minecraft. I feel like that was mostly relegated to awful fucking mobile or Steam games.
Yes.
And but then Dragon Quest Builders just kind of came out of nowhere. It's like, here's like this game that like we are clearly heavily inspired by Minecraft and like the phenomena that Minecraft created, but totally does its own thing with it.
Totally does its own thing with it. Because like it's really only Minecraft on the most basic surface level, in that the world is built out of blocks that you can break down and collect, and you know, your kind of item bar looks the same. But once you get past that, just the basics of like how is the world built, what are some of the most basic mechanics, it doesn't really take from Minecraft at all. It's a Dragon Quest game. Like, it is a video game with a long, in-depth, you know, story mode slash campaign, whatever you want to call it, with a lot of things to do that are really deeply ingrained in the mechanics and reward you for that. You know, Minecraft is just a great toy box. I shouldn't say just, but it is a great toy box, you know? And I don't ever want to put that down. I love Minecraft. I spent years in love with Minecraft. I think I'm probably past that moment in my life now, but I'm never going to deny that that game had a big impact on me for a couple of years. But it's the kind of thing where I think for Minecraft, one, for me at least, you kind of have to have friends to play it with. And two, you have to have just a certain desire to want to just go in and play with it, because you're never going to finish it, obviously. You're never going to, like, overcome something that makes you feel like you're finished with the game. It's like having a really great Lego kit or something,
right,
and playing with it to your heart's content. And I think that's one of the reasons why it is such a phenomena, deservedly so, with children. But Dragon Quest Builders goes in a very, very different direction, where the goal of this game is to make you feel, put you on a path where your building really feels like it is a critically ingrained part of a fairly interesting story it is telling about a broken world that your character is tasked with rebuilding. And everything it does really makes, like the progression of this game is so insanely rewarding, because it really makes you feel like the work you do building pays off in real, tangible ways within the world. And I'll talk about that more in a second, but I could see you smiling at this.
Yeah.
The story setup for Dragon Quest Builders, I just want to high-five everyone involved.
Uh-huh.
The game starts with the end of Dragon Quest 1.
Yes.
So, like, deep cut. You're back in the world of Alefgard, the very first Dragon Quest game, and I guess at the end of that game, the villain, like, tempts you.
The Dragon King tempts you with, he offers you, he makes you a choice, because you've gone through this whole quest, because I have played Dragon Quest 1 now.
Yep.
Like, after having played the demo for Dragon Quest Builders, you make your way to his castle, saving the princess, defeating the dragon, going to that town with the goal in front of it, do all that fun stuff, and you make it to the Dragon King, and he's like, hero! You have, like, well done making it here. And he offers you this choice of either you can defeat him, or he will give you half of the world, and you will rule the world together with you having 50% of it and him having 50% of it. And if you pick the bad option, he basically just kills you. But most people presumably just say, no, fuck you, you're like the evil Dragon King. I'm not, no, buddy, I think I'm just going to defeat you. But yeah, this game takes place in what if you pick that other thing where the hero betrays everything he stands for and decides to take this deal for half of the world.
Yep, and it starts from that point and then goes way into the future. The world's destroyed, almost like a Zelda Breath of the Wild kind of scenario, where like there are people still around, but they live in ruins. And you awaken as your player-created character, boy or girl, and you are the builder, as a mysterious disembodied god tells you. And you are the chosen one who has the ability to build things, which as part of the Dragon Lord's curse, all the people of this world have forgotten how to do. They literally don't know what the word build means. You have to explain the concept of putting two things together to make something new, and people find this revelatory, and that's genius!
It's so good.
And the writing throughout this game is, like, off the charts amazing, but particularly, like, it just strikes you in those first couple of hours with the game of how well they are selling that incredibly silly concept by just rolling with it. Like, there's something very particular about the quality of Dragon Quest's writing, in that it's very Toriyama-esque in a lot of ways, honestly.
Yeah.
In that it's sort of unassumedly silly and funny, and it doesn't really take itself too seriously, but also has a lot of kind of heart and pathos to it. And So yeah, you start the game and you get this flag and you go to a town settlement and you put the flag in the ground and then you start building outwards from there. And first one person comes to your town and is like, oh my god, this is amazing. You can build things. What is building? It's like
you put a stick and a rock together and got something different from it. How is this possible? What is this concept? You're blowing my mind.
And you continually find more people and you bring them to your town and they give you rooms to build. And sometimes, and you can build whatever you want, of course, also. And you sometimes they'll just give you a vague idea of what to build, but you slowly learn how to build all these things. You build this settlement. And the game is constructed as essentially four connected but separate campaigns, four chapters. But they continue narratively, but not mechanically, because basically, like, you get to the end of chapter one, go through the portal to chapter two, you lose all your stuff, you lose, like, all your health points, like, your progression, and, you know, you don't go back and visit those characters again, and now you're in another part of Alefgard that you have to rebuild, and you kind of go through that again. But in each of these chapters, each of these separate campaigns, as I was saying, what amazes me most is that sense of progression you get in that one. There are all these characters around who are so well written and so fun to just have in your town. And it feels really, truly rewarding to talk to them and do things for them and see them get happy about the things you've built. And like that first chapter is really all about defense, like building a settlement for Cantlin, which is this first kingdom you're in, and making sure you can defend everyone from this giant evil golem that's going to come destroy you. Also a Dragon Quest staple, I take it. And so, you know, you're trying to do that. But like the more you build up that town and the more people you get in and the more rooms you build for them and the more defenses you build, you just feel so much accomplishment because this world feels so living and breathing and magical. And part of that is that it's got all the Dragon Quest style to it. It's all of Toriyama's art designs, all the monsters you fight out in the world, because you do go fight monsters. It's kind of like Minecraft in how you fight monsters, but much better. Like, it's not as messy as that.
Yeah.
And there's more weapon options to choose and whatnot. But they're all the Toriyama art designs, like the skeletons and the slimes and the ogres and things like that.
The Drakies and all that kind of stuff.
Because those games have the best monster design in any JRPG.
Yes.
Because kind of how could they not with him doing the design?
Yes, if you want to fight things that have pauldrons with weird spikes on them, Toriyama will provide for you.
Yes, and they're all out there in the world for you to go fight. So there's that, and then the music is all from various Dragon Quest games. I don't think any of it is original to Dragon Quest builders. I know in Chapter 1, the overworld theme is just the overworld from Dragon Quest. Which is so good.
It's very good.
And then they change up those things in subsequent chapters, and I don't know if they're new or not. I take it they're other overworld themes from other Dragon Quest games, but I don't know the series that well. I think I recognized one of them. But anyway, so it's got the Dragon Quest music and style, and it uses the same typeface, and the English localization is fantastic, and actually draws on some things from Dragon Quest's history as Dragon Warrior, in that they do it differently in every chapter, which I think is smart, but in Chapter 1, they very much do that kind of old-timey English, like Shakespearean kind of writing that they did in some of the original translations.
Yeah.
Which I think it's not necessarily the absolute most faithful way to translate it, but I do think it's an interesting and fun localization technique.
Yeah. It gives it a flavor.
And it really fits with the style of the game. You know, and then in Chapter 2, people sound different. I'm in the middle of Chapter 3 now, and everyone there is written like they're super Cockney or something. Huh. And it's fucking great, though. It's one of the best, like, dialectical kind of writing things I've ever seen in terms of, like, putting dialect into text speech. I've realized I have to read it much more slowly to catch everything they're saying, but you just hear the words in your mind. It's very, very well written. But what I was getting at is because you have all these things and the world is so fun and magical, I just found myself, I'm playing this kind of like Once Upon a Time I Did Minecraft, where you just get kind of obsessive with it, where like you want to build the best shit you can build. And in the first chapter, Cantlin in particular, because that one is so about defense, like I built like really tall walls around my town and I got a lot of defensive stuff. And I was just, every time there was a monster attack, I was super ready for it. And I just had so much fun building all the traps and stuff because they really give you all the tools for it. It reminded me of Once Upon a Time. Why did I say Once Upon a Time?
I don't know. A long time ago. I'm still a little sick,
and it's going to my brain. Once, a couple years ago, when I was still like deeper in the throes of Minecraft,
I remember those days.
Yes, I built like as I was wont to do back then, built a big castle in Minecraft, And then I built a moat. And then I was so into it that I built, like, big turrets on the castle. And I got these big, like, towers on the castle that I, like, stocked with, like, chests with all these weapons and armor and stuff. So it looked like a defensible castle that if monsters were attacking, you could go up and get your bow and everything. And my brother kind of saw me doing all this while I was building this. He's like, monsters don't attack you in Minecraft like that. Why are you building all this? There's no point to it. And I kind of was like, I know, but it seems fun. Dragon Quest Builders is that with a purpose.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You really do get to outfit your town and your townspeople and really prepare for things. And because there is that in-universe motivation for you doing all of these things, it just feels so motivating. And all the building you do feels so rewarding. And I think that's a really cool, magical innovation on the Minecraft formula. I'm not going to say Dragon Quest Builders is better than Minecraft, because I think it's attempting something abjectly different than Minecraft.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, like, they're really, despite looking similar, they're very hard games to compare. But if that's the kind of thing you've ever wanted out of Minecraft, like more of, this is the game for you. If you have any love of that kind of open world building thing and any love of JRPGs, this is as perfect a marriage of those two things as I could imagine. And I am just enjoying it so, so thoroughly. And the other thing I'll say is that it's surprisingly non-repetitive too, because I was kind of expecting at the end of chapter one that chapter two would be the same thing generally, but like harder. And it's not. Like, the goal of the settlement you build in Chapter 2 and what you're doing with it is not about, like, building the best defenses and fighting a bunch of monsters. In Chapter 2, you're in this part of the world that has been beset by, like, a plague, and you are building, like, infirmaries, and you're trying to find stuff in the world to make medicine for them, and you're going around rescuing people and bringing them back to your base and healing them. And it's just, that is, like, such a cool, like, innovation on the sort of Minecraft formula, because there's nothing like that in Minecraft. So, like, right. They really get into it. And Chapter 3 feels like it's also going in a different direction. So I think this game is brilliant. And, you know, kind of the only reservation I had going into it was, I know Dragon Quest Builders 2 is coming out in the near future. And I was wondering, like, do I need to play Dragon Quest 1 or Builders 1? Should I wait for 2? If you have any inkling of wanting to play this, play Dragon Quest Builders 1. Like, there is enough special about this game that obviously there, unless Dragon Quest Builders 2 is some kind of weird, like, it's the same game just with different features, which I don't think it's going to be. It'll probably be a new story and new scenarios. This game deserves to be played on its own merits, and I would really highly recommend it. The Switch is a perfect platform for it, but I also assume on PS4 now you could get it for like $20. So I very, very highly recommend this game.
Yeah, that's awesome. It was always something playing. I loved that demo so much that I always meant to get around to it, but it was like 2016, 2017. A lot of video games.
I wish,
like, it ever got there.
I don't know if I would say I wish I had played this in 2016, because I really like playing it on the Switch now. And it just, again, it's like, this is a really good game for me right now. Because also, like, you can play it in very short bursts and then right. Put it down and come back to it. But if I had played this in 2016, which was a great year for video games, this would have been very, very, very high on my top 10. I don't know exactly where. It's kind of hard to rank with, like, games from years ago. But, you know, we had games like Doom and Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth 1 and Uncharted 4 and Final Fantasy 15. And this is up there with all of those. Yep, Hitman. Just
you never gave Hitman quite its full due in the actual year of 2016.
No, I did
not. You were a late bloomer. Hitman bloomer.
Well, you know, it's I got there eventually.
Yeah. Murder catches up with us at a different pace.
Okay. My murder flower blossomed in its own time.
Exactly.
I also have on here, I wrote under stuff, Dragon Quest Builders and Jonathan's Neurotic Switch Shopping Spree.
Okay.
Should I talk about that too?
Okay. Sure. I don't know why. I have no idea what it is.
Sometimes when I get neurotic and stressed out, neurotic from stress, and like, especially if I'm flush with any amount of cash, sometimes I buy things that I probably shouldn't.
Oh, yeah.
And this this is the story of that. Dragon Quest Builders, I will not say this was fully an impulse buy, because I've wanted to play this game for a while.
Yeah.
And it was like, I'd played like 50 hours of Digimon Story at that point. I was kind of ready to take a break. I was also boxing up my PS4.
And you knew that you liked this game from playing the demo and everything.
Yeah, so I think this was a very smart purchase.
Yeah.
Good, I'm happy with it. Yesterday, on the 16th, another Switch game came out, which was the Bayonetta 1 and 2 collection, which I've also known I want to play, because I've wanted to experience those games. Bayonetta 3 is going to be coming to the Switch. I need to play those. And, you know, I have the, like, discount at Best Buy with the Gamers Club unlocked. So I'm like, you know what? I don't know if I'll have time to play right now, but I'm going to go over there and I'm going to buy that game as well. And I bought that. And I played a little bit of Bayonetta 1, not enough to talk about it. Seems cool. And I did not have the problem with the download code some people have been having.
Okay.
Which sucks if you've had that. I feel bad. I also just I wish they would have just put them both on a cart. It's weird because I have Bayonetta 2 on the cart and then Bayonetta 1 taking up 10 gigs on my SD card. It's just a little, it feels wasteful in a weird way.
Right.
Oh well. But yeah, it's cool that they're both there. Runs cool. That game is fucking bizarre.
Oh, yes, yeah. No, I played probably like half of Bayonetta 1 because it was, I think it was a PS Plus game when I had a brief access to that PS3.
It's a very Japanese game.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's tremendously Japanese. But anyway, so that's cool, and I will get around to that at some point. There's not a ton between here and like mid-March when things get crazy again. So, and those aren't like super long games.
Yeah.
But at the same time, okay, I also got an email of, so I have, it's a weird thing, but I like have a Best Buy Rewards account that I have my Gamers Club thing with. You know, we all have those different accounts for different stores, right?
Yes, yes.
And on a different Best Buy account that I think used to be my dad's, and when he died, I switched it to my email address, but I never really managed it or anything, like that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That, at some point, other people in my family, I guess, had shopped enough at Best Buy using our old phone number associated with that account that I got an email with a $20 gift card for Best Buy.
Great.
And I'm like, okay. And I tried to use it to buy Bayonetta 2, but I couldn't do that and my Gamers Club thing in the same purchase because they were separate accounts. And that shaves off like $13, so I wasn't going to... That would wipe out most of the gift card.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, this thing actually expires in like a month because it's a reward certificate. I want to... I'm like, I'll just buy some Nintendo Switch credit and I'll use that at some point. And I got that with it, and I did that and got $20. And meanwhile, I had been thinking a lot about how much I wanted to play Doom again in the midst of all this.
Okay.
And I think it was partially prompted by... My brain is really neurotic right now. This is why there's a lot of free association going on.
Okay, yes.
I think Bethesda had announced they were doing a new patch for Doom on the Switch to make it to fix some things that had been going on. Okay. So that was like in my ears and earworm. And I was like, you know, I really want to play Doom again. I'm so intensely curious about that Doom port for Switch. Not necessarily on the level of like that would be my preferred way to play the game. Just that like... I love the Nintendo Switch, I love Doom, I want to see what that weird chemistry is like. So I was also like that same day, I was like, oh, fuck it, I'll use this $20 in my account, and I'll also buy Doom on the Nintendo Switch. And so,
okay.
I've bought three full-price Switch games in the last week.
One of which you all, there's a version of a game that you already own on PlayStation 4.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have played the first level of Doom on Switch handheld. It is a fucking trip, man. Because obviously it's not the nicest looking version of that game. On the handheld screen, at least, it looks totally fine, runs totally fine, and it is really trippy to play Doom on the Nintendo Switch with my, you know, candy-colored Joy-Cons on the side.
Right.
I did find that I could not play it on my preferred difficulty setting. I had to turn it down one notch because I was having trouble aiming with the Joy-Con sticks. Everything else was fine.
Yeah.
Like, the triggers and stuff are fine for shooting. And, of course, the Pro Controller exists, so that's not... But it's in a box somewhere for me right now. So, anyway... Yeah, I really went from, like, having a couple games on my backlog to now I've bought, like, four games for Switch because Bayonetta was 1 and 2.
Right, yeah.
And I'm still playing Dragon Quest Builders, though. That's where my heart is right now. But I think it was it was three things. It was the mix of being stressed out from the move and a lot of work and different obligations. And it was all these games kind of coming out at once. Not Doom. That came out last year. I don't know where that came from. And also getting my tax refund in last week. I think I got too cocky about money.
It happens to the best of us. Because I have been playing another game. I'm not hiding this, but I didn't have that much to say about it. But now that you're talking about your weird purchases, I bought, because it was on sale about a week ago, I got Dragon Ball Z Universe 2.
Oh, nice.
Because it was something I always was like, because I enjoyed Xenoverse 1 quite a bit, recognizing... That game is broken in some amazing, weird ways. To recap, in Dragon Ball Xenoverse 1, with the Xenoverse games are the ones where you can make your own character and you play through sort of like the history of Dragon Ball as this time traveler from the future that has to fix things that are going wrong in the history of Dragon Ball, which is a great premise. It's basically the same premise for Xenoverse 2. In Xenoverse 1, though, if you played as a Saiyan character and you turned Super Saiyan, you could spam your ultimate attack infinitely for as long as you were Super Saiyan. So you like all you had to do in that game was get your like energy bar up to its absolute maximum. So every time I leveled up, I split my points between like energy blast super attacks and energy bar. It just got my energy bar super high up, and you just turn Super Saiyan and it just shoot giant Kamehamehas for like 15 minutes and you kill everything that way. That's how Xenoverse 1 played. And then I knew from playing the beta and other sectioned of the Sean's beta corner from some time ago, that there's universe to fix some of that stuff. And while I really love Fighters is also a game that stresses the fuck out of me when I play it online, because it 100% hits my like competitive thing that I usually don't get super competitive about stuff, but every once in a while I'll play a game that like I get really competitive about, and I think there's something about the one-on-one nature of a fighting game that it really hits me. And so I can't play, like, I would have a heart attack if I played Fighters online for like an hour a day, you know, like, right. It would just kill me. The stress would literally kill me. So I was like, well, I have, like, I want to play a game, and I don't quite want to buy Monster Hunter World or something, because that seems like that I will just, like, that'll take up all my time, because I'm also playing Fighters, and I play a little bit of Fighters basically every day because I want to get better at the game, but I can't play it that much. I need something else to do. Xenoverse 2 is on sale, and it's pretty cheap. And I know that that's a game I can just sort of play when I'm already stressed from other shit and don't want to put, like, this competitive stress on top of it and just chill out. So I have been playing Xenoverse 2 and kind of Fighters side by side, which is, like, a kind of a fun experience because they are so completely opposite Dragon Ball games. Xenoverse 2 is, like, I kind of wish that they had made Xenoverse 2 was the first Xenoverse game, because it is so similar to the first one, but just, like, makes some key improvements that makes it a much more fully fleshed out game that also doesn't have the you turn Super Saiyan just spam your attack infinitely, so that I'm forced to actually play the game instead of just cheating my way through it practically.
One of the many Dragon Ball game traditions Dragon Ball FighterZ has bucked is the feeling of playing it and being like, ah, the sequel's going to be so much better, you know?
Right,
because that's like every Dragon Ball game is you play the first one and you're like, it's okay, the sequel's going to be the good one and I'm going to be burned out by the time it gets here. FighterZ does not have that quality. Xenoverse very much had that quality.
Yeah, no, I think that's why it was kind of a good thing that I didn't play Xenoverse 2. I think it came out last year, so it's like I like sort of missed a year with that game. So it's been long enough since I played Xenoverse 1 that it's feeling kind of fresh. And I have been having quite a bit of fun with it. Like, it's nowhere near as good a game as Fighters, but it like hits that Dragon Ball fan service bit really well. And I've loved some of like the goofiness of the game. I think I talked about this when I talked about the beta. But one of the great touches they make in this game is that you can upload your save from the first one, and that will allow you to carry over some techniques, and it gives you some money and stuff. But the real reason why you want to upload like your fighter from the first game is that it canonically, within the fiction of Xenoverse 2, your character, the Time Patroller, whatever you named them from the first game, is like Trunks's Time Patrol partner, and like all those events happened, and like they're this like super hot shot, like the sort of like second founder of the Time Patrol Academy, because you are playing as one of like these like dozens of Time Patrollers that now are doing this shit, and like you go to this academy and this whole like expanded hub world instead of like the little tiny hub world from the first game. And so To commemorate the fact that this character from the first game saved basically the entire like continuum, like time continuum and the multiverse and all that shit, they have erected a hologram statue of him slash her, him from in my case, in the middle of the town hall, and it's just a big hologram of your dude, your like dopey looking Dragon Ball guy from the first game standing there with a smile and a thumbs up, and it is the best thing, and he shows up in some cutscenes. And that's fucking awesome and dumb and makes no sense, because it's also like that guy should be so powerful at this point that I don't understand why they have any problems with him around, because it's like, I played this dude. He can shoot Kamehamehas for like 10 minutes straight. He's like the most powerful guy in the universe. You can't fucking beat him. But yeah, it has a lot of that goofiness and goofy sense of humor in the way it'll like take scenarios in Dragon Ball and say like, oh, like what if I played one of the like side quest things they have the other day that was, I thought, a really funny premise of what if another cell from the future went back in time and ended up, so you have an imperfect cell from the future that accidentally ended up in the Cell games as perfect cells fighting Gohan. It's just like this, and you basically have to help him somehow. It's like, I kind of lost the thread of what the weird plot they were going for was, but just the scenario and hearing Wakamoto have to sort of deliver lines to himself as imperfect cell and perfect cell. It's just like, there's a lot of goofiness like that. That's a lot of fun. Another thing about the game, though, I think one of the reasons why I've been enjoying it as much as I am is that I decided to make a female character this time as opposed to a male character last time, so I'm playing as a lady Saiyan named Cress, that this is because you have to stick with some sort of vegetable-esque name, and I like heartily recommend playing as a female character. There are for several reasons of just like it's fresh, it's interesting for Dragon Ball because there's not many female characters in Dragon Ball. But the main reason is that one of my criticisms of Xenoverse 1, and it carries over for 2, is that there are very limited fashion options that are not just clothes from other characters in the games or from the show. So, you know, the vast majority of clothing options you have are like, this is like Vegeta's Saiyan armor from when he came to Earth, and this is it from, you know, in the Cell Saga, and this is Goku's gi, and this is like Gohan's outfit, and this is Piccolo's outfit, and this is Trunks' outfit. And so the vast majority of the clothing options are all just it makes it look like your character is just cosplaying as Dragon Ball characters. And I never liked that much because I wanted my character to have their own unique look. And it's kind of hard to piece together a good looking outfit that's like pants from Goku's gi and like Saiyan armor from like for like the like chest piece or something. Like none of those outfits are modular that way. They're all designed as a piece. So that never doesn't work that well. What does work, though, is that if you're playing as a female character, all the armor has to be slightly redesigned to fit a, like, female frame instead of a male frame. So, like, the cut and the silhouette of the outfits looks so, like, different enough that it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm just some loser cosplaying as Captain Ginyu. I'm some super cool Super Saiyan chick that is, like is wearing an outfit that looks like Trunks' outfit, but it's different enough looking that I don't feel like I'm a copycat.
You feel like a pro cosplayer.
Exactly, yes.
Yes, it's like you're Jessica Negri in Dragon Ball or something.
Yes, it's not just that I'm copying the outfit, I'm riffing off the outfit.
Yes, like really there we go.
Making it my own. Yeah, that's... It's like, stuff like that is... It's fun, of being able to just sort of make your character, get a look for your character, and kind of like... pick out your moves, because there's just a fucking just stupid number of moves in this game at this point, because there's all the moves from Xenoverse 1 and then a bunch of new ones, so basically anything, any mild attack sequence that was ever featured in the history of the entire show is basically represented as some sort of special attack you can equip on your character.
Well, Dragon Ball Xenoverse 2 is on the Nintendo Switch, so who knows, if I don't have better impulse control, I could own it this time next week.
Yes, it's very true. I recommend it. It is fun. It's one of those of like if only if you're a Dragon Ball fan, there's stuff for you there. If you're not a Dragon Ball fan, like there's nothing for you in this game.
Yes.
But yeah.
Yeah, I still gotta get back to FighterZ, so someday. All right, you want to move on to the news, Sean?
What's going on in the news, Jonathan? Well, in the dumb news, Jonathan.
In the dumb... Right. We're not moving on to real news. We're moving on to stupid entertainment news so we can riff on it. There we go. Movie trailers. Let's do a movie trailer.
Yes, it's our great tradition.
Last time on the show, we did the Super Bowl trailers. Yes. And we had the Super Bowl teaser for the full trailer of Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Yeah.
Because that's a thing we do now in our stupid, morally... creatively bankrupt culture.
Well, I'm looking forward to when we have the 2 second long Super Bowl spots that advertise the 50 second long teaser trailer that is on YouTube that teases the full 90 second trailer that will be put up on the company website later in the week.
Yes, exactly. Well,
then I think our society will be fixed.
Yes. But we got the full trailer for Solo, A Star Wars Story. Notably in the Super Bowl spot, we didn't see Han Solo. We saw Lando Calrissian, which I think might have been the wrong choice to do because you just foregrounded what's going to be the best character in that movie.
Yeah, like because right after that TV spot, I think I like saw it right after we recorded the podcast, was someone posted on Twitter what at the time I thought was like an awesome piece of fan art that was like Lando in big letters with Donald Glover as Lando in the background. And then later I realized, oh, that's like an actual poster. Now, I thought it was someone made this fan art for like, what if they made a Lando movie that just was called Lando with this version of Lando and all that shit that we saw in the trailer. It's like, that would be great. So it's like, it's an official poster for the movie. You guys have no idea what you're doing because it's like, you're making a poster for a way more interesting looking movie that has like little tiny letters at the top that says Solo, A Star Wars Story. It's like, I want the Lando movie because that looks fucking awesome.
It looks amazing. I mean, Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian is pretty much like the hottest person to ever be on screen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. I do wonder if anyone at Disney this weekend, because of the success of Black Panther, is having a discussion about recutting Solo once again and bringing in like a different director again.
Let's get Ryan Coogler.
Get Ryan Coogler.
He's not doing anything at this immediate second, probably. He's just finished a movie.
Yeah, he just finished a movie. He'll come in and redo Solo as Lando.
We'll have to put Michael B. Jordan in there somewhere.
Yes. Oh, there's plenty of roles Michael B. Jordan could play.
Yeah.
It'd be great. He could be the guy in the Chewbacca costume for all, you know, who cares?
Chewbacca takes his head off. Yes. It's like it's Michael B. Jordan underneath. He has some serious concerns about how Wookiees have been treated in society.
Indeed. No, but yes, it would not surprise me, frankly, if Disney made that choice because you know, I don't think Solo is going to do as well as Black Panther.
No, who knows? Probably not.
So, okay, let's talk about... It's fun to talk about the movie we want, which is... I don't know how you could get Donald Glover in that costume and then be like, yeah, let's just have him be a supporting character. That's a leading man.
Yeah, no. God damn it. So, it's like, and then I don't know how then later in the process someone put up that poster and they're like, fuck! Fuck, that poster's so good. Like, if we put that up on Twitter as, like, the teaser for, like, instead of, like, all this Solo bullshit, we're making this, and here's our first image, Lando in big letters with Donald Glover as Lando in the background. Like, fucking, it's a game over.
Yes. Yes. But no, the trailer we actually have isn't bad. I don't want to, like, dunk on it or anything. You know, we got our first look at the actual Han Solo, played by Alden Ehrenreich. I was struck, I guess I'll say, by how little they're going for making him look or sound like Harrison Ford.
Yeah, like, I was particularly, like, the voice was what kind of threw me off. Of like, I'm sure I'll get over it if I watch the movie, but, like, it's... Harrison Ford has such an iconic, really deep voice that, yeah. Like, that's so much of what I associate with Han Solo kind of comes from that.
Right. And it is... I mean, it's on one level, I do totally understand the impulse probably should not be just imitate Harrison Ford because he is quite literally inimitable, I think. Yeah. And it probably makes sense for Alden Ehrenreich to try to make the role his own. And I should say, this is an actor I like. I said when he was cast after his role in Hail Caesar, he was cast in the Solo movie. That's the Coen Brothers movie. He's so fucking funny and perfect in that. I thought... Yes, that's perfect casting. This trailer is by no means enough to get a sense of how he'll be as Han Solo. But it was just kind of jarring of, like, they're not trying at all. Like, not even in, like, the speech patterns as written. Uh-huh. Like, there's that moment at the end, which I think is kind of a funny little scene, like, in complete isolation of them going through, like, the thing. And they hit the tentacle monster. And he's like, we're fine, we're fine, we're fine. And then they hit the thing. It's like, cause I think the actor is, like, funny and charming in that moment. It also does not feel like a Han Solo moment to me.
Yeah.
So who knows? But, yeah, I mean, we see him. Get a little more Woody Harrelson. We saw Lando, though not nearly enough in that 2-minute trailer.
Yeah.
It looks like Star Wars. There's some nice shots. We talked about this last time. It's like there is such a built-in formula to the Star Wars trailer at this point. And this one hits all of those same beats.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I have much to say until we see the damn movie, but who knows?
Like, one thing I'll say is, like, the one line in the trailer that kind of ground my gears was when, at the beginning in a voiceover, Han's like, they kicked me out of the academy because I had a mind of my own. It's like, shut the fuck up, Han Solo. Like, what the fuck? Fuck off.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, maybe I would have been, like, way into that if I was 13. It's like, yeah, you rebel Han Solo. It's like, you stupid fucking kid. Get over yourself. Jesus Christ.
I mean, there's every possibility this could be a good little Han Solo movie, and we'll see. It just, I don't know. It really, there's, even having, you know, just come off a Star Wars movie we both really, really liked.
Yeah.
There's fatigue when you do this often, because...
And when you do it this often, then, like, it feels like you're not breaking out of that box. Or, like, we kind of broke out of the box in Last Jedi, and then it's like, go back into the box. And maybe that's actually the biggest problem, was that we saw the brightness on, like, the other side of that horizon, and they're like, maybe in, like, the Rian Johnson trilogy we'll get back there. But for now, let's go back to our safe little Star Wars box over here. So
yes.
I won't go back there. I like the new shit.
I know. It's a weird sensation, because Disney clearly wants Star Wars to be its own Marvel Cinematic Universe-sized property, right?
Oh, yes.
And I think if you were imaginative enough, Star Wars could be something like that.
Absolutely.
There's enough stuff you could do with it, but you'd have to be willing to make a lot of Star Wars movies that don't look like our current definition of what a Star Wars movie is, and we're not there yet. And I do think we're at a point where you can feel that before 2015, there were 6 theatrical Star Wars movies. Now, after in 2018, there will be 10. Like, we've almost doubled it in 4 years. Like, it really is a nutty thing. And I think you can feel the weight of that just on the fandom. That's just kind of like, even some of the arguments around The Last Jedi were just, I think people were tired of having them at a certain point, you know? And we're going to be tired of them with Solo. I'll go watch it. I hope it's good. I think it's weird that this movie's coming out in May and we still don't know what the directorial credit on it is. So there's that.
Yeah. Like, I'm sure I will see it if for no other reason than this podcast.
Yes.
But I think there's a really huge, like, possibility that if we did not have this podcast, I would not see this movie. Like,
yeah.
And that was, like, a really shocking feeling watching that trailer. It was like, Like, you know, I was not super convinced by some of the trailers for, like, Episode 7, but there was no world in which I was not going to go see that movie. And I actually was very convinced by the trailers of Rogue One and then saw that movie and was not convinced by the movie itself. But it's like, you know, that, like, Rogue One, yes, like, even though I wasn't sold on the basic pitch of it, it's like, I'll go see that fucking movie. It's like, I'll go see Episode 8. And then, like, seeing that Solo Star Wars trailer is like, your Star Wars story trailer is like, eh.
The one thing I'm kind of hoping, and this will transition us into our next thing, because yeah. I would say I'm hopeful, and then this piece of news broke, and I don't know what to think anymore. Yeah. But is that after Solo, it's like Solo, A Star Wars Story, and Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, are like the two most obvious first spinoffs you could do. The Death Star story, and the spinoff of your most popular original trilogy character, right? Yeah. Like, do that. Like, you know, thank God they have not yet announced their Yoda and Boba Fett and movies. I'd take the Mace Windu movie, but we're not doing that.
Yes, apparently. I would love a fucking Mace Windu movie, honestly. Yes.
Yeah.
After watching some of the prequels again. I mean, well, specifically, I would like a Mace Windu Yoda. If you're going to do a Yoda movie, it should be a Mace Windu Yoda buddy cop movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we don't need to digitally de-age Samuel L. Jackson. He can just be younger, and we don't mention it, and it'll be funny.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. No, anyway, what was I going to say? I was like, at the very least, like, this is kind of the last gasp of that initial, like, flurry of announcements for Star Wars stuff back before Force Awakens.
Right.
And we haven't heard of what the next spinoffs are. Like, we know, I think Stephen Chbosky is working on, that's not the right name, I forget who's working on it, but someone is working on an Obi-Wan movie, but we don't, that's not even greenlit, technically.
Right.
We know Rian Johnson is working on something, we don't know what, and my hope is that, okay, maybe they got all the most obvious stuff out of their system, and we'll get to the next thing, but who knows. Then the day after the Han Solo trailer came out, we got the news that David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, the creators, writers, showrunners of Game of Thrones for HBO, you might have heard of it. It's kind of popular with the SEO crowd, I hear, on the internet.
Exactly, yes.
Are developing a new series. This didn't even have, they didn't say trilogy, they just said series. So this could be 20 movies, who knows, of Star Wars films. And I think everyone in the world banged their head against the wall. Not because these guys are untalented. That's not the point. It's that in a world where you have Star Wars and you could do so many different new exciting things with it, you hire your like 20th middle-aged white guy who saw them in the theaters when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, stop. It's enough. Like, get someone new.
Especially after, like we were just talking about, getting a trailer, which was for me like the Star Wars trailer that's like, I'm not sure if I would normally go see this movie, because like I kind of have a relatively high bar for movies I'm going to go see to the theater.
Yeah.
Of like whether or not it's going to have something in it that like, oh, this is a movie I want to see. It's like, nah, didn't really clear that bar anywhere near close to on its own merits. And it's like, then right after that, it's like, here's another series of movies after they just announced they're doing another trilogy with Rian Johnson, which is like, I'm excited for that one now because I like The Last Jedi, but it's also like, you can't just do this. Like, you can't just keep on saying, like, I want to at least hold on to this hope that there will be one year again in my lifetime where a Star Wars movie doesn't fucking come out so that I can build up some sense of anticipation for this franchise I love and,
yes,
and want to continue to love and do not want driven deep into the fucking ground by this endless onslaught of films every single year. And yeah.
I also think, and I think a lot of people pointed this out, there's kind of two camps in the Game of Thrones criticism at this point of people who think that the show has, like, some people think the show has clearly improved on the books and it's its own thing and it's great and these two guys are geniuses. And there's other people who are more in my camp who think that I think they are very, very, very adept at adapting the books when they had the book material for the most part. Sometimes they were not so adept. See invented rape scenes. If you're adding rape to material, don't.
Right.
Just like, we should just have a sign on the wall. You can reduce the amount of rape. Maybe get rid of it. That'd be great. Don't add rape.
Yeah.
You know, don't, D-A-R, don't add
rape. Yeah, it's pretty, like, yeah, if you're adapting to something and you're putting more rape scenes into it, they're probably not needed. They're probably not necessary, is my guess.
But I think in general, they were very good at adapting George R. R. Martin's source material, getting it into a TV format, casting it outstandingly well, getting great directors, all that stuff. I do think the seasons, the first four seasons of Game of Thrones are great. I think 5 is a really rough season, 7 is a super rough season, and 6 is pretty good. But like, since they have gone off book, it has been significantly rougher, and I'm not sure what these guys' qualifications for fantasy storytelling is in a complete vacuum. because the brilliance of the Game of Thrones show comes from the books, and I don't think they've added a lot of brilliance to it. And taking that and then going to Star Wars, I just don't know. Maybe they have a great idea and a great pitch, and it's something new, and Kathleen Kennedy at Lucasfilm was like, I can't not make this. This is so brilliant. And I hope that's the world it is. It could also be like, we're going to tell a story about rebels in between episodes 3 and 4. And it's like, okay, yay. And white guys tell another story about Star Wars, people. Yay.
I mean, yeah, because what it just felt like to me as someone who has not watched Game of Thrones yet was just like, here's the people who made Game of Thrones, which is like the most successful media property in like the last 5 to 6 years or whatever.
Yes.
Like, and they're open now, I guess. They were going to make that Confederate show or whatever the fuck that was going to be.
Yeah, that's the
guess
one.
That's not happening. I don't know.
That's the best thing about this is maybe they won't get to make their stupid, tone-deaf, racist fucking Confederate show for HBO.
Yeah.
But who knows?
So it seems like they're not doing that, and they're going to be free once Game of Thrones is done until eventually the books are finished, and then they come back and make Game of Thrones Brotherhood later. But there's your deep cut anime joke. Because I am endlessly fascinated that now American, like, Western television has encountered this problem that anime in Japan has been fucking dealing with since the 70s. But anyways, they are open and free now, and they, like whether or not they are actually the reason why Game of Thrones, the TV show, is wildly successful, you can sure convince a lot of shareholders and people that, like, you know, that you're going to need to convince of this kind of shit, that these two guys are the reason this is successful, so let's get them to make Star Wars movies, and you can get anybody to make a Star Wars movie. Like, you could go walk up to anybody's fucking door right now and say, hey, we're Disney, make a fucking Star Wars movie. Make a movie in, like, the most beloved pop culture franchise ever, probably in the history of humanity, basically. And here's, like, $5 billion. Go fucking make it. You can convince anyone to do that. So, of course, they would try to go get the people that fucking make Game of Thrones, the TV show.
And I guess for me, it's just, put their talent aside for a second. We have J.J. Abrams, Rian Johnson, we were going to have Phil Lord and Chris Miller, and they still will have directed some of the footage in the Solo movie, I presume. And now these guys, all of a similar age range, you know, same demographic, probably same kind of mix of influences, who all have, I think, probably a fairly similar view on what Star Wars is or what it should be. And that's the thing to me. I want to see some kind of diversity, ideologically, racially, gender-based, whatever it is, in how we make these Star Wars movies. And it's just like, you know, if I'm Disney managing Star Wars, I would just look next door on the lot to Marvel and be like, man, Marvel movies really got better when they started hiring, like, black people and the New Zealand guy. And over here on DC, that Wonder Woman movie by the female director who, you know, we had blacklisted from Hollywood for 10 years because she's a woman, I guess, that was really good. We want more of that. Like, that's the weird thing to me. Like, yeah, I would love the Lando Calrissian or Mace Windu movie, and one of those is probably going to get announced after Black Panther.
Yeah.
But who knows? But we're not getting anything that's that out of the box. Like, I would love to see a movie, a Star Wars film, from someone in that same age range who is not a white guy, because they would just have a fundamentally different POV on what Star Wars is, and I want to see that new POV.
Exactly.
That's the exciting thing. And there just does come a point. They can, maybe this is wrong, but they can only make so many Star Wars films.
No.
And if there's all,
no limit.
Okay.
There's no upper limit.
Okay.
They announced two series of new movies within a year of each other at those announcements. There's no limit, Jonathan.
I guess all I was going to say is that the more they announce that are the same kind of group of people, the less likely it is that we get more interesting, new, fresh names in the mix.
Yeah.
The other thing that annoyed the shit out of me about this announcement, and it is not the fault of Benioff and Weiss, it is not the fault of Disney, they said nothing to the sort, but fans online going like, we're finally going to get the R-rated hardcore Star Wars movie.
Oh, that was stupid as shit.
What do you mean? Who wants R-rated hardcore Star Wars? What is that?
Yeah, no. Like, it's like,
like, you know, even, like, Knights of the Old Republic isn't, like, an M-rated game or something.
Yeah, no. Like, there's some Star Wars stuff that deals with some darker themes, but, like, you know, like Star Wars, the Clone Wars TV show dealt with some darker themes, and like Star Wars Rebels has some like dark shit in it, but like dark for a family show, you know?
Yeah, like
that's the, it should be that. It would be like someone asking for R-rated Doctor Who. It's like, no, what? No, why?
Yeah, it's like,
what's the point?
Because Star Wars, like Doctor Who, can be, should be, is best when it is many different things. One of the things it shouldn't be is R-rated. Uh-huh. It should not be exclusionary in that way to an age range. Like, that's weird. I don't know what in your head would make you want the R... Unless, I guess, it's the Lando movie where he can talk like a dude in a blaxploitation movie. That's the only one I want. But even then, I would feel a little weird in the theater.
Yeah,
let's be honest.
Like, that's where you... I went with... I would only accept an R-rated Star Wars movie if it was R-rated because it was a screwball R-rated comedy, not because it's, like, some R-rated gritty bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, if it's going to be R-rated, it might as well be funny instead of being, like, dark and gruesome and gritty.
Yeah, and... I also just... I do think Benioff and Weiss... They've done some work outside of Game of Thrones, and I know, I think... One of the two, I think it's Benioff, is an author who's written some pretty acclaimed books as well. But at least on the screen, I just don't have a sense of what their work is like outside of the Game of Thrones context. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they write for women and my, like, there's literally, I think, only ever been like one or two black speaking roles on Game of Thrones. One of them is largely in a made-up language. So, like, you know, the women, they have a lot of well-written women characters. They also, again, invent rape scenes for them sometimes. So it's just, there's a lot of question marks for me of what their talent set is outside of that very narrow show. So it's a weird announcement. Disney gonna Disney with Star Wars, whatever.
Yeah, Disney is never going to write this ship until they get Rachel Talley to make a Star Wars movie. I will say it every fucking time we talk about Star Wars.
I people were throwing around other names when this came out, and I had to make my tweet that I make every couple weeks of like reminding us that maybe the best sci-fi, visual like sci-fi of this decade was probably directed by her on Doctor Who.
Exactly.
So, yes. Anyway, let's talk about something even stupider than all that.
What could be stupider than all that, Jonathan?
Sean, Sony made the Venom movie.
God damn.
These crazy bastards, they did it.
They finally took the, like, one. I'm finally wrong about something of that I feel like we talk about movies on this podcast sometimes that I just say that movie is not happening. Most of the time, it's not happening. Yeah. Most of the time, this like shit never comes to be. They're actually making the fucking, like, once they put out a trailer, that's when I'm convinced, okay, you're actually making
Although,
the fucking movie.
I'll say this, non-zero chance it's a joke. Do you remember for the Super Bowl there was that thing with Danny McBride where it was a pretend Crocodile Dundee sequel
that actually
looked like something that could be a pretty funny movie in its own way, but it was just a Super Bowl ad, we found out. There's a non-zero chance Venom is an ad for something else, and we don't know it yet.
I wish I could be as optimistic as you.
Not a big chance, just a non-zero chance.
Okay.
That's all I mean. Could be 0.1, could be 1. Non-zero.
I mean, to be fair...
There's no footage of Venom in it!
Yeah, there's no footage of Venom in it, and while, like, in the copyright text it says Venom, nowhere in that trailer does it say Venom. It's just a big V.
Yes. Because
I saw it in front of Black Panther. Again, though, it's like, I didn't really want to see the trailer again, but they made me see it again.
Yeah.
It's like, sure, you get some white splotches that sure look like the eyes and smile of the Spider-Man villain Venom, but considering the fact that Spider-Man's not in this movie... It can't be a Venom movie. How do you make a fucking Venom movie?
Let's
detach from Spider-Man.
Let's go back for a minute. History of this project. Which totally makes sense if you don't know this, because this goes back a long ways. Spider-Man 3, which has a character named Venom in it.
Yes.
I don't know if we can say it has Venom in it. Has a character named Venom in it. Character named Eddie Brock. Since that movie came out, and in the fallout of that movie was a big hit... But also, like, all the people involved with that movie did not ever seem super up to doing another one.
Yes, because that character supposedly named Venom was not put in that movie because the director, Sam Raimi, wanted him in the movie.
Yes. So ever since Spider-Man 3 sort of landed, Sony had been working on the side to try to get a Venom movie made, like a Venom spinoff. I think initially it probably would have been a direct spinoff of Spider-Man 3 with... Topher Grace playing Eddie Brock.
Yeah, everyone was so enthralled by that performance.
It's not Topher Grace's fault.
That's a fair point. I mean, yes. It didn't seem like great casting, but...
Yeah, no. Anyway, I actually feel bad. Topher Grace is an okay actor, and I think that destroyed his career, and it's not his fault.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, but yeah. So ever since then, they've been trying to make a Venom movie. I remember remember the first script for this that they were working on back like in 2007 was a young writer named James Vanderbilt was working on that. This led to a whole bunch of things because he wound up being the writer who was writing Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 4, which never happened. And then he was the guy who wrote the initial draft of The Amazing Spider-Man 1. Like, he was ping-ponging around all the corners of that franchise for like 5 years between 2007 and 2012 when The Amazing Spider-Man came out. And one of the projects he was working on was this Venom script. So they have been trying to make a standalone Spider-Man-less Venom movie for over a decade.
There is some fucking executive at Sony who has the biggest hard-on for Venom imaginable. That's the only explanation for this. There's no reason to make this movie other than that.
I'm not a huge comic book person, Sean, but explain to me, you know a little bit more about comics at least, is Venom a huge solo character that way?
Kind of. Like, I mean, yeah, before we get deeper into the movie stuff, let's cover Venom from my point of view, because, you know, like, we have gone, like, comic book movies have gone so obscure at this point, my role as, like, the comic book guy on this podcast was robbed, like, 4 fucking years ago.
You was.
Because I no longer have the expert knowledge on Guardians of the Galaxy and shit. It's like, I don't know enough about Captain Marvel to give the Captain Marvel speech, you know, when that movie comes out. But I know a lot of shit about Spider-Man. That is still my fucking beat.
I'm gonna
walk my beat. Yeah, so Venom was introduced after the Secret Wars miniseries where a bunch of different comic book characters got swept away and had to fight on this alien planet, blah, 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 blah. Spider-Man, during the events of this big crossover event, found this alien synthetic black suit that he used to replace his normal Spider-Man suit that got destroyed in the course of battle. He wears that suit when he gets back and doesn't realize that the suit is not just sort of like this sort of like super powerful alien like synthetic suit. It's actually alive. And it is an alien organism that is feeding off of him and is feeding off of his negativity and making him more aggressive and all this stuff. So eventually he rips off the suit on like this famous scene that they, you know, they took for Spider-Man 3 at the church and all that shit. The symbiote suit drops off, lands on this guy named Eddie Brock, who then becomes obsessed with Spider-Man and becomes the supervillain Venom, who is half driven by the symbiote that is this alien organism that is trying to reconnect with Spider-Man because of how powerful Spider-Man is. He wants him again. And so Venom is this sort of like crazy lunatic, like alternate dark version of Spider-Man, who was a really popular character in the 80s and 90s because he fit that sort of like more gritty comic book scheme. I like Venom quite a bit. I think he can be a fun, cool character. But like his popularity kind of got spun out of control and they did a bunch of spin-off characters like Carnage and Toxin and all this shit. One thing they did do with Venom that is very interesting, I think, is that eventually the symbiote suit split off from Eddie Brock and sort of bounced around from a couple of different hosts. The most interesting one to me was when it was attached to Flash Thompson, who you might know as, like, asshole bully from every, like, origin Spider-Man movie that just beats up Peter Parker for no good reason. That Flash Thompson joins the military, eventually, like, gets joined with the symbiote suit as part of, like, a secret project and becomes, like, a super secret Agent Venom guy. And that's a really cool idea. I didn't read a lot of those comics, I didn't think were actually that good, but the idea is super awesome. And that would be, like, that's where, like, my mind goes if you say Venom, like, Venom as a spin-off property of, like, a standalone Venom thing. That's where my mind goes, is that there have been standalone, like, spin-off comics with Venom that star that character and basically that character removed from Spider-Man, but has been typically in the guise of it being associated with Flash Thompson as, like, an anti-hero Venom, not just Venom.
Yeah,
Eddie Brock Venom.
Because there are obviously some characters, like supporting characters in superhero universes who go off and stand on their own. Like, Wolverine is the most obvious example of that.
Yeah.
But, like, Catwoman, like, we laugh at that because of the Halle Berry movie. It would make sense to make a Catwoman movie.
Yeah,
like,
that's
fine.
Totally fine on stage.
Yeah. Don't do it like the Halle Berry movie, but, no. You know, that makes sense. Venom is just not on that list, though.
No.
Like, it's a very weird thing, but someone at Sony has wanted to make a standalone Venom movie for a long time, and it has survived multiple iterations. It was going to happen under the Raimi films. It was going to happen. They actually hint at it in The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yes.
But again, the plan wasn't for Venom to be a villain in a Spider-Man movie. It was for him to be in his own movie and then lead the Sinister Six. Like, they want him as his own movie, and even now that they, you know, gave the rights back to Marvel, or, well, they gave the creative rights back. They're still making the money, but it's like, we don't know how to make these movies. You make them for us.
Yes, and even after their own insane, bizarre plan to make a Spider-Man-focused superhero cinematic universe that was just about Spider-Man and his supporting characters in Venom and the Sinister Six and all that shit, which is what they were trying to set up in Amazing Spider-Man 2, one of the reasons why that movie fucking crashed and burned, and then imploded that entire universe around on it, then forcing them to share Spider-Man with Marvel again.
Yeah, the Venom movie is the cockroach in the nuclear blast in all this. It has survived every detonation of Spider-Man continuity, where they have been trying to make this fucking movie, and now for this one, they finally made it. It's directed by Ruben Fleischer, who I realized I have seen all his movies, even though I only remembered one of them. He's made Zombieland, which is okay.
That's an okay movie, yeah.
It's fun, definitely fun. He made 30 Minutes or Less or something, or Safety Not Guaranteed. No, it was called 30 Minutes or Less. It's got Jesse Eisenberg and Aziz Ansari and Danny McBride, and it was kind of funny. It's like 70 minutes long, whatever. And then he also made the movie Gangster Squad. The only thing I remember about that is that's the movie where there was going to be a scene where they shoot people in a theater, and then there was the Aurora shooting, and then they changed the movie, and it was a shooting just in a different venue, because that was the issue with it, I guess.
Right.
And that movie was not good at all. So he's kind of a weird journeyman, you know, Hollywood director who has no real identity, but he's making the Venom movie. They somehow got Tom Hardy for this, which... That was not... If you had asked me, what is Tom Hardy's career trajectory, I would not have said star of the standalone Venom movie.
Yeah, like, especially after Mad Max.
Yes. And Michelle Williams is the love interest. I think those are the only actors we really know are in the movie.
Which is, like...
Also weird, Michelle...
Venom love interest? What? Yeah, I don't know. Like, who? I don't know. I legitimately don't remember who that would be.
But anyway, so they have, you know, this very, famous star in the film in Tom Hardy... They have kind of just they grabbed a director off the shelf and made the movie. And then after all these years of like, what is their Venom movie going to be? We get the trailer. It's like, it's not really a teaser. It's like 2.5 minutes long.
Yeah, it's a normal, by all accounts, it should just be a normal trailer for a movie and not a teaser. You're correct.
It's like long. And it's like Tom Hardy narrating the worst dialogue I've ever heard over some very just... inexplicable images of him brooding. Like, you don't really know what's going on at all.
Yeah, there's no, like there's no pitch going on at all.
No, and then the trailer just ends. You never see the symbiote. You never see Venom.
You see, like, one vial with black bullshit in it that presumably is supposed to be the symbiote. But it doesn't, like the way that it's presented does not lend it any significance. So much so that, like, I kept on waiting for, like, I was looking for that shot when I saw the trailer for the second time in the theater because I remembered it when I watched it online, and my mind went so, drifted away immediately, and I missed where that shot was in the trailer. I was like, wait, was it in it? And then I had to, like, kind of go through it really quickly on YouTube, just be like, okay, yes, that shot is in there. I didn't just dream it.
And there's never, he's not even, like, in the shadows. You just never see Venom. At the end, there's a V. And the thing I was thinking is, like, okay, I've been following this movie's development for 10 years. I had no idea what was going on in that trailer. If you were, like, in the audience for Black Panther this weekend, for instance, and you're just there to see a cool movie, and you see that trailer, and you don't know what that is, or even if you kind of do, what the fuck do you make of that? It's the worst piece of marketing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you what the movie is.
It has the, like, Marvel Studios logo thing at the beginning of it. And when that happened, like, I was, wait, what the fuck is this trailer for?
Well, it's got the Marvel logo, not the Marvel Studios.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's got the Marvel. Yeah. It's just, I was like, what the fuck is, like, what Marvel movie is coming out? This has, it's like, is that Tom Marvel? Oh, right, that Venom movie.
Yeah.
I watched that trailer 2 days ago online.
It's so weird. Like, I just imagine a bunch of people when the trailer, like, ends just kind of scratching their heads, like, and asking their friends, like, what's the title of that? What is it?
Yeah.
Because, like, I don't want to see it. Nothing was interesting in that trailer. But what is it? I'm kind of curious what the fuck movie that is. It's it's inexplicable.
Then they turn to the comic book person that went to the movie with them that conveniently has to, like, explain all the post-credits bullshit in Marvel movies. And they're like, what trailer was that for? It's for the Venom movies. Like, who's Venom? It's the Spider-Man villain. Well, Spider-Man wasn't in that trailer. Well,
here's the thing.
Yeah, you're right. There's no Spider-Man in that movie, I guess.
Because I'm not... People are not... We don't know 100% what the legal deal is. It sounds like they cannot use Tom Holland's Spider-Man in this. They might be allowed to allude to him, but it cannot be set technically in the Marvel Cinematic Universe because it's not... produced by Kevin Feige. It's not like a Marvel film.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they do not want to be saddled with this bullshit continuity if they ever want to use Venom in their own Spider-Man movie.
Yes. So, makes no sense. Nothing about this makes sense. It's going to bomb so hard. It's kind of like... It's in that there's most superhero movies these days are actually really good. There's been a lot of good ones lately, but we can't get every couple of years we get one that's just like it feels like a superhero movie from the 90s when they didn't know what they were doing. Like that Fantastic Four remake was like that. This looks like that.
Yeah,
Justice League, yeah, frankly, like. Yeah,
it looks like either like it's from the 90s or that like mid-2000s where like Catwoman and Daredevil were just or like the old Fantastic Four movies were just like dumped. It was like had no identity, no sense of themselves. It was like the X-Men movies were the standout ones, and even those are like good for a comic book movie at the time, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of comic book movies, DC has started shooting their next movie after Aquaman. So Aquaman's coming out this year. And if you thought, oh, is their next movie going to be like Wonder Woman 2? Or is it going to be like some other cool new character they could do? Or they find
Man of Steel 2. They
Man of Steel, they could do that.
Like a sequel to their fucking Superman
movie. Is it that Batman movie we keep hearing about? Is it a Martian Manhunter movie? That'd be cool.
I hope it's Suicide Squad 2. That was an Academy Award winning film, you know?
I hate the world. The next, Suicide Squad 2 is happening, but the next movie that they are shooting, is Shazam! And no, it's not a movie about a genie with Shaquille O'Neal.
Unfortunately, that would probably be better.
It absolutely would. This is happening with David F. Sandberg directing just another... He does kids' movies or something. I don't know. Zachary Levi from Chuck, who I do like, is starring as Shazam. Mark Strong...
What? That's weird. Why, like I assume adult? Because, like
Well, he's the adult.
Okay, version. Yeah. That's just like weird casting. Like
they've got a kid playing the kid, and then Gatson. He turns into Zachary Levi.
Yeah. So like for people who do not know, Shazam slash DC Captain Marvel.
Yeah,
which I assume you're going to say for people who don't know, which is almost everybody,
yes,
right?
Because
it's a really obscure hero. Like if you watch a Justice League cartoon or like Young Justice, like he's in those shows and stuff like that. But Captain Marvel slash Shazam, because he was originally called Captain Marvel, which is not the same as the Brie Larson Captain Marvel movie that Marvel is making, because they're two different Captain Marvel characters. And by the way, that Captain Marvel is based on not the first Marvel Captain Marvel. She's like the third Marvel Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers. But DC has their own Captain Marvel that I think predates the Marvel Captain Marvel. But DC Captain Marvel is a kid named Billy Batson, who's like this pure-hearted young kid who stumbles into some weird cave or something that's over that, where there's like this magic Merlin-like bullshit dude who then says like, oh, like if you say the magic word Shazam, it'll give you the power of like the wisdom of Solomon and the speed of Hermes, and like Shazam is some like acronym that is all these like mythological figures and shit like that. And then, so if he says Shazam, a lightning bolt drops from the heavens instead of just like immediately killing it, like killing him like a lightning bolt would anybody else. It turns him into a superhero, like Superman looking kind of dude with a big lightning bolt on his chest named Captain Marvel, who, when they made the New 52 reboot in DC Comics, they decided it's too fucking confusing to have a DC character named Captain Marvel when there's a Marvel character named Captain Marvel. So we're just going to call him Shazam because that's his catchphrase. But I don't remember if they actually called him Shazam, like, in the comic book, or if that was just the name of the comic book. Either way, it's Shazam.
I don't think they're calling him Captain Marvel in this, because I think they'd get into rights issues.
Yeah, and it would just be confusing as shit. Well, because I think it would be fine from a rights perspective, because they both legit, like, they both have Captain Marvel comic books.
But movie trademarks, it's sort of like when Avatar came out, and then The Last Airbender couldn't call itself Avatar, you know what I mean? Like,
sure,
So these things do come up sometimes. But yeah. I don't know what the fuck this movie's gonna be. I just do. What is DC doing? The second movie they're doing after Justice League is Shazam. Where is this coming from?
Well,
they can't get a fucking Batman or Superman movie made, but we can get Shazam made.
The one thing I know about this, I don't even know if it's confirmed that he's in the movie playing this role, but I know for the longest time, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, the man who should be the next president of the United States of America, if we're going to elect another man, it should be the fucking Rock. That's all I'm saying right now. Is he has for the longest time been like, I want to play Black Adam, who is the, like, you know, he's the Lex Luthor to Captain Marvel, Superman, basically. And I assume that he's playing Black Adam?
No, he's not. Because he is confirmed to play Black Adam, but not in this movie, because they've pulled a Venom and they've pulled him out of this movie.
What?
And they're planning a separate Black... This is all confirmed.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, the Black Adam movie has been in development longer than the Shazam movie, because at some point in the development of these properties, they broke off because they thought The Rock was a big enough star, which he is, to be fair.
Yes. Yeah, but...
To do a Black Adam movie, that has been in development longer, but it got caught up because... because I think The Rock is too busy. And so they were like, well, let's just make the Shazam movie, but we'll save Black Adam for later, and they're not going to be related, like, in the same continuity or anything. So that's what they're doing. He's not in it. There's no relation. They might make a Black Adam movie at some point, but it's been in development hell for, like, longer than the DCEU has existed.
Who the fuck is the villain in the Captain Marvel / Shazam movie, then? What the... Also...
It's the Joker again. Like, no, I'm kidding.
Here's this wicked, crazy idea, Jonathan. Stop me if you think that this is too insane an idea to actually do. What if we took this character, Captain Marvel, who in the comic books, granted he is white, but is like this big, super muscular, like heart of gold character that is incredibly charismatic, and you look at him and it's like, this is like the best of humanity. It's basically Superman with the heart of an 8-year-old. What if we took that character and we cast him with the fucking Rock?
Yeah,
dude who is like super charismatic, built like a fucking tank, and is, you know, has like the most charming smile in Hollywood.
And basically,
and like, who gives a shit if he's black? That doesn't mean you have to cast him as a character named Black Adam. That's kind of racist. Like, yeah. Just cast him as Captain Marvel.
And they even, The Rock just starred in a movie, Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle, that's basically Shazam, where a kid becomes The Rock.
Exactly. It's the fucking Rock.
Yeah, I don't know.
Just Captain, if that's such, that would be perfect casting. Just cast him as Captain Marvel.
Makes no sense. Now I'm thinking of of him in the Brie Larson Captain Marvel costume, and I'm all fucked up. So let's move
that
on.
That would work for me too.
Variety also reported in even dumber DC news that Joaquin Phoenix is in final talks to play the Joker in Todd Phillips' standalone Joker origin story movie. And this is the point where my news outline sounds like the dumbest Mad Libs anyone's ever filled out. Of like, star who's never going to be in this movie is going to be in director who's never going to make the movie that's never going to get made.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, did Hollywood just lose its fucking minds and think that, like, oh, the next thing we need to do with the superhero boom is make a bunch of standalone supervillain movies that aren't even spun off from the superhero property, are just like, because, like, we already have a fucking Joker in the Suicide Squad bullshit, and, like, but we're not going to use that character we already set up, we're going to do a different character that isn't set up in any existing Batman thing, to do an origin story for the Joker, which is not a great idea to do at all, and with a character that's like, how the fuck do you make a Joker standalone movie? Who are you going to get to, like, what sad, sad person are you going to saddle with this impossible task of writing a fucking Joker movie? Joker is the main character.
Sadly, it's fallen to Todd Phillips is the answer, apparently. I don't know. The Joaquin Phoenix, here's the thing. Joaquin Phoenix is I think a brilliant actor. I might be my pick at this point for like actor of the decade because of the trifecta of The Master, Inherent Vice, and Her, which came out in like 3 years in a row and just three perfect movies he's in. And
He's a great actor.
Great actor. But he is a very mercurial actor who like only does, you know, art house stuff. He has not been in anything mainstream in a long time. Like, you might have to go back to, like, Walk the Line or something.
Right.
Which is not, like, that kind of movie doesn't even get made anymore. So, you know, like, this isn't the kind of thing he does. I can understand, like, Joaquin Phoenix has flirted with this before because I assume he'd like the money. You know, I don't think Her pays all the bills, you
sure,
know.
Sure, yeah.
But, like, he was in talks to be Doctor Strange in Marvel. And what broke down is that he did not want to do, like, 5 movies. He wouldn't sign that kind of contract. He's like, I'll do 1, and maybe I'll do more. And they're like, well, we need you to, like, sign your children away so we can do this for 10, 20 years.
We need your soul. Like, it's the only way this shit works, man.
Yeah. And he doesn't want to do that. I assume that's the same kind of thing that will eventually break this down. Unless it's an ironclad, like, this is a 1-movie thing, and then you're done, and you never have to promote it or anything. But who knows?
Yeah.
Also, I love Joaquin Phoenix. One, this sounds like a complete waste of his fucking time and talent. Two, I can't picture him in the makeup. It's weird. It's just weird.
Well, other like, because the only way I can picture it is like, I'm just basically picturing like a Joker with a big bushy black beard. And I kind of like that. I kind of like that mental image.
Yeah.
No, but like I just keep on going back to it in my head because this is true of both the Venom thing and the Black Adam thing. I just, like, can't think of how you turn make a movie. I can't think of how you make a movie about those. Like, I think there are some supervillain characters in comic books that you could make a standalone movie out of. But I don't think you can with Eddie Brock Venom. Like, I have no idea how you do that. especially if it's completely disconnected from Spider-Man, which is basically the like prime motivation of that character in the comic books, comes from wanting to reunite and like become Spider-Man again, basically. Like, I don't know. I do not know what the fuck a standalone Joker story is completely removed from Batman. Like, I have no idea. I don't know how you would ever write that. The character's not built for that in any way. Like, yes, they are popular characters, but it kind of reminds me of what happened with, like, Pirates of the Caribbean, where everyone thought, like, oh, Jack Sparrow's the super popular character. That means, and, like, nobody, like, nobody's going to see these movies to, for, like, Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley. So they want to go see fucking Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow. So what do? You just, like, get rid of those other characters and just, like, make Jack Sparrow more and more the focus, and, like, Johnny Depp just go, like, deeper and deeper in his own insanity. But it's, like, that's not what that character is. The reason why people like that character is because he can function as a brilliant supporting character, not as the lead character of the fucking movie. Jack Sparrow's not a protagonist. Venom is not a protagonist. Black Adam is not a protagonist. The Joker's not a fucking protagonist. That's not how storytelling works. And unless you're getting some brilliant genius writer to do this and write a really outside-the-box, like, brilliant, weird Hollywood movie, that's you're not going to make that movie work at all.
It's just, DC is in this space now where I guess they've decided that none of their characters work on screen other than Wonder Woman, and maybe Batman if they can figure out how to get Ben Affleck out of the franchise. But they're like, so we're just going to go to the F list of, like, you know, who's the most obscure characters we can find, or characters who aren't protagonists, and do that. And it's weird. Like, Marvel didn't start with Guardians of the Galaxy. They had to prove they could do fucking Iron Man.
Yeah.
And then you can do Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, it's like, Marvel's not going around saying they're going to make a fucking Red Skull movie, you know? Like, that's not happening. Like, they're not even trying to make a Loki movie.
Right,
because
right.
They know that wouldn't work. Yeah. It doesn't matter that Loki is super popular. You couldn't, like, how could you possibly make a standalone Loki movie? It's like an impossible story to write. Because the character's not built like that. The character's awesome. Every time he pops up in a Thor movie, like in Thor Ragnarok, I loved Loki in that. I would never want to go see a standalone Loki movie. That sounds like absolute dog shit.
All right. Well, Sean, let's talk about something that was decidedly not absolute dog shit.
Yes.
Black Panther.
Fucking yes.
All right. Quick, spoiler-free reaction to Black Panther, because we forgot to do it at the top of the show. Sean, what'd you think of Black Panther?
I think it's a brilliant, brilliant, just fantastic superhero movie. Like, I think it's a great movie just on its own right.
Oh, yeah.
Well outside of the genre. I think it is a canny movie for this time. Like, well above and beyond just, like, sort of the how just nice it is to have, like, the representation there. It's what it does with that representation of race, and particularly, like, the female characters, I think is, like, so great that it's, like, that's a part of it. Also, there's the sort of intersectionality component that it's not just you have a black superhero, but this, like, great supporting cast with a lot of great black women in it as well. But it is what it does with those characters in that setting of talking about race in this moment and talking about, like, sort of, like, I think dissecting and interrogating the fantasy of Wakanda and what that means for like, the African-American identity and the sort of racial struggles going on right now and issues with immigration and stuff like that. It is a movie that is so of this moment, and it is executed at, like, the top of its game. It is among the best, if not the best, Marvel movie. It's, you know, got everybody's just brilliant in this movie. The acting is out of this fucking world. It has the best villain in a Marvel movie, and, like, one of the most interesting and compelling plot structures in a Marvel movie in terms of how it plays the hero and villain character together and arrives at a really powerful, soulful conclusion. And it also has, I think, the best, like, post-credit scene, like, not the post-post-credit scene, but, like, the main post-credit scene since the, like, first one that, like, was like, holy shit, they're, like, actually trying to do this multiple movie thing.
The Avengers
one with Iron Man. Like, this has one that, like, again, like, this movie has such heart and soul to it, and the, like, the note it leaves on is such a mic drop moment with Black Panther that I just love this movie up and down.
It's amazing. I did not know Marvel had this in them in terms of how political and just deeply artistically intelligent and soulful it is.
Yeah.
But I did know Ryan Coogler had it in him. And I think that's the thing that is most jaw-dropping about it, is that Ryan Coogler, I think, is just one of the great talents working in American film today. And it has been a true privilege over the last few years to get to follow this guy's career from inception to now. Because this is his third film. And I remember seeing Fruitvale Station, his first one back when it came out, also with Michael B. Jordan, whose career I've also been following since he was a kid in The Wire. He's so great. And Fruitvale Station is this little indie movie about police brutality, because it's about the last day in the life of Oscar Grant, who was killed in New York by police officers. He was pinned to the ground, shot in the back by a cop. He was unarmed. And that's what that film is. It's about the last day in his life up to that scene. And it is an amazing, powerful, hold-no-punches work. And then he made Creed. And Creed is a movie that should not fucking work on paper. And yet right. It is one of the smartest, canniest, most interesting Hollywood films to come out this decade, because of how it takes the, you know, the Rocky plot structure, which is one of the most familiar plot structures in movies, right, you know, in the last 50 years or something,
yeah.
And does it to tell a story about the legacy of black men in America without fathers. And that's what that film is about. And about the need to be seen as a black person in America, which is also in many ways what Fruitvale Station is about. And that Ryan Coogler could further his, you know, incredible meteoric career through a project like that as his second film is amazing. That he then would come to Marvel and do Black Panther. And this feels in many ways like his most personal film, his most soulful film, one that is a Marvel film. It doesn't, like, you know, just cut all ties with the universe.
Right.
But it also, like, so elevates what a Marvel movie can be, so completely rewrites what these films are. And to see that, I think he could solidify in one fell swoop his ongoing legacy as an amazing filmmaker, a filmmaker who has this really broad audience appeal, because look at the box office numbers for Black Panther,
yeah.
And just like the Twitter around this, and like the way people are reacting to this film, and doing that all in one fell swoop. And the dude is only 31 years old.
Right.
Just if y'all want to feel bad about your life accomplishments for a minute. It really is an amazing moment. And that intersection of Marvel kind of just giving Ryan Coogler the keys to the kingdom and letting him truly make a Ryan Coogler movie. Because we have had... Marvel has gotten... And I think it's one of the big things that has made Phase 3 of the Marvel experiment the best yet. Is they've done a lot to give directors and writers more agency and putting their voice into the films, like Taika Waititi in Thor Ragnarok,
yeah.
Or James Gunn in Guardians 1, but particularly Guardians 2, I think. And that's really his own thing. And here I think they've done it more than ever and said, you know, I think there's just a lot of trust in saying, like, the Marvel crew is a bunch of white guys. We probably don't know how to tell Black Panther right.
Yeah.
But Ryan Coogler and all the amazing actors and all the people you have behind the scenes, because he brought a lot of his own people on for this, like, you probably know how to make Black Panther, and he made fucking Black Panther.
Yeah.
And it is amazing. And I think, like, it's hard to say at this point what the best Marvel movie is, because it's kind of like, what's your style of Marvel movie you want? Because there's been a lot of good ones lately.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I think it's pretty obvious to me that this is the best Marvel movie, just from the standpoint of, like, what is the best film that has come out of that studio, like, in terms of the artistry on display, the storytelling on display, the resonance with the culture we live in, how riveting and just exciting an experience is in a theater. Because I'd like to ask you about this too, your theatrical experience, because it was totally, like, packed opening night crowd, electricity in that theater during that whole movie. And I saw this in North Denver, which is where you tend to have more of a black population up there. So this theater wasn't just all white people, which you would get down here in, like, you know, Lakewood or something. But it was a nice mix. And I just, there was a little black girl sitting like two seats away from me. And I just, there's one moment where I think it's one of the moments where the general woman, Okoye, I think is her name, does something badass. And that happens all over the movie.
Yeah.
But she was just like, dang! And it was just one of the, because it was like the movie went to silence for a second and the little black girl said that. It was like, that was so awesome. I loved that.
Yeah.
But there were moments like that throughout. All of that together, just, this is a true landmark cultural film moment and a great film to boot. And that's a long spoiler-free reaction, but there's a lot to say about this movie.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. All right. So, spoilers from here on out. So, that was our spoiler-free reaction. If you haven't seen it, go see Black Panther if you can get a ticket. It's kind of busy right now. But you should go see the movie, and then you can come back and listen to our spoiler cast. So, Sean, here's my first thought as we get into more spoilery stuff with Black Panther.
Okay.
I think Chadwick Boseman is amazing in this.
Yes.
I think I've loved Chadwick Boseman since 42, where he played Jackie Robinson. Great actor. He's so good in this. I love the accent. I love the physicality. I love how much weight he brings. Like, you see the weight on T'Challa's shoulders through this whole movie. And yet he's like my 10th favorite character in this movie.
Right.
And I don't think that's a problem, but it is so interesting because there's not a lot of superhero movies where you can say that.
Yeah, no, this is definitely a movie that feels like it is more ensemble than is typical. Like, yes. Like, you know, like Black Panther / T'Challa is definitely the main character and like the protagonist of the movie. But it is, there's an emphasis on the supporting cast, like the general, like Shuri, his younger sister, his mom, his love interest. You know, M'Baku, the man-ape in the comic books, they very smartly did not just call him man-ape in this movie. Like, that was a good,
I didn't know that.
That was a good choice. But, like, yeah, like, I'm not super familiar with Black Panther from the comics, but I know a little bit. But I think, like, he's awesome because he's the leader of the tribe that lives in, the snowy mountains and stuff.
He's
all
great.
That. Martin Freeman as the token white dude. So good.
I love
that Martin Freeman gets to come back because I now know that the character that he's playing is a supporting character from some Black Panther comics, but I didn't realize that when he was in Civil War. Because I don't think I don't even remember if they said his name in Civil War or not. But like, I really liked him because I like Martin Freeman and everything. He's fucking Martin Freeman. How do you not like Martin Freeman?
If you need a white guy to react to crazy, amazing, wonderful things and just take it all in stride, you get Martin Freeman, and that's his role in this movie.
Yeah, no, he does such a good job with, like, the weird specific role he's given that I also, like, I want to talk about that character when we get deeper into, but it is just such a great, his role, and, like, everything that it says about, like, representation in movies is fantastic. He's awesome, but then obviously it's, you know, Michael B. Jordan as the villain.
As Killmonger
is unfucking believable in this movie. Him and like his acting and then the role that they give him and his theme, all three awesome, amazing.
His last line in this movie, where he is sitting there dying with T'Challa and says something to the effect of "Bury me in the ocean with my ancestors who jumped from the ships because they knew it was better to die than live in bondage."
Yeah,
you could hear 600 people in my theater. You could hear a pin drop.
Yeah.
I could not believe I heard that line in a mainstream Hollywood movie. That's the kind of thing you would get in a Spike Lee movie, and white people would get really mad about it, you know? And this is in a fucking Marvel movie. That is just a mic drop of a moment. But what makes him a villain for the ages is the effect. I mean, all of that and the story he has is so emotional and impactful on its own. But what I love is what it moves and pushes T'Challa himself to do. And that the status quo of Wakanda and the world we meet is notably different at the end. And T'Challa has made major decisions in his role as the Black Panther and the King because of his interactions with this antagonist character.
Yeah.
And all of that put together, like, it does not pay lip service to the things it wants to engage with. It engages with them. And I think that's something that just you don't really ever see in superhero movies.
Yeah, it's really rare. It's something that it feels like the next step up from what Thor Ragnarok did. Because Thor Ragnarok felt like it did some of that stuff as well, like talking about colonialism and actually like tackling it and dealing with it. But also that movie did it in a lot of like really funny ways and used humor to sort of tackle that stuff. Whereas like Black Panther's like fucking just dives into it. And it is like there are moments where it, like you said, it feels like a Spike Lee movie. Like it feels like more of like an art house movie about race than it is like a big like blockbuster superhero film, you know?
Because they haven't sanded any of those edges off to like make it palatable, which I also think is going to be, I think we'll get to this later, but I am so curious what the like commercial impact on Hollywood this movie is going to make. Not just, I mean, the money it's going to make, but what is it going to tell about how we can rewrite the rules of what Hollywood movies can be? Because this breaks an awful lot of them.
Yeah, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah, up to and including the idea that, you know, oh, people don't come to see the big $200 million movies with black people in them. Well, that makes no fucking sense because there's a lot of black people in this country. And also, like, there have been black stars since movies were invented.
Yeah, have you not met Will Smith or my man Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
Yeah, no.
But so, come on.
But this one being actually targeted towards a black audience about racial issues and, again, not sanding those edges off. Those are all rules that I think Hollywood, in its very crusty old white ways, has thought were set in stone and this movie says are not.
Yeah.
And we're already getting kind of sidetracked. But what were you saying before?
Oh, I was just also about, I was going to say also, like, one of the things this movie feels like, I was going to say a 1-2 punch, but I guess it's sort of like a series of hits of like three for me of like what I'm kind of tracking in my head of like you had Wonder Woman and Get Out also felt like they were like precursors to this. That like I like Wonder Woman a lot, but the Wonder Woman does feel like a slightly more sanded down studio version of like what Black Panther feels like. It gets away with more in terms of like it's like where Wonder Woman feels like it loses track of sort of like really tackling the like gender issue about halfway through the movie, and like I liked Wonder Woman a lot, but it was not a complete slam dunk for me. Whereas like this movie feels like it's like no, like it just goes for it. Like it never loses sight of like what it represents and stands for everybody seeing it. That is, it's like, you know, it is the having this like almost completely black main cast, but then it is also about like the message that the movie is sending in its text itself.
Yeah, so we'll get into the text deep soon enough, I'm sure. But I think I want to start with just the surface of this film, which is one of the most resplendent surfaces I've ever seen in a film.
Right, yeah.
Because not only is this, you know, an all-black cast aimed very much at a black American audience, this is a proudly, unashamedly, enthusiastically African movie.
Yeah.
In that Wakanda isn't like, they don't just make it like some random fantasy nation. It is in Africa, and it is African, and it has all these fantasy elements, but like they so clearly, everyone in this movie did their homework of like, what do we want to use from African culture and African diasporas to put together into this film? And a lot of cultural critics, particularly African American ones, have done much smarter analysis of this than we can do about how this belongs to kind of the growing subgenre of what's called Afrofuturism, which is sort of sci-fi and fantasy built around African culture and diaspora, as I was saying. But I think what this movie does is just this blend of the accents and the language and the voices and the costumes and the set design and the world. Sometimes when you're just out in like the environment in this film and looking at the sunsets and stuff, it is... And then what it does, again, textually, of bringing all that African culture into the American context and what it has to say about those links between Africa and America and the people who, you know, came here on the ships and have been abused ever since and those things. It's amazing. And I think as a piece of world building, Black Panther is as good as any movie I've ever seen on that.
Yeah.
Like, we've been talking a lot about the Star Wars prequels in our series we've been doing, and one of the main reasons we stand up for those films is that they are amazing, I think, unimpeachable pieces of world-building.
Yeah.
I think Black Panther is easily on par with those.
Yeah. No, you know? I agree. It's especially, like, yeah, that the scene when, after the sort of, like, the prologue-y bits, and then you get the... Black Panther gets the love interest character back, and they're like, okay, now we can go, like, it's time for my coronation, let's go back to Wakanda, and then they're flying into the mountain, and it cuts to T'Challa, and he says, I never get tired of this, and then they fly through, and you see Wakanda, and you're sort of flying through, and you see all the people, and just, like, sort of the fiction of the different tribes that they sort of explain at the beginning of the movie that came together to form Wakanda, and you see that, like, you know, they all have their own unique identities and fashion and culture, and all of those are represented and pulled from different African tribes. As you're saying, there are a lot of former educated people about that stuff that you should find online that dig into all of that.
So much good writing about this movie.
Yeah.
Some bad stuff, too, but largely a lot of good.
But there's a lot of great stuff to go find and just to, like, dig into the rich detail that they use to build out this world. But I think one of the things that is the most interesting parts of it to me is that it is, like, it's this weird thing of, like, it is, you know, looking at Africa from an African-American perspective. That it is not, like, it's what I think, because it feels like a very African movie. But I think it's, like, it's important to remember that, like, it's not an African movie.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It is made by an African-American director with, like, a lot of the actresses in particular, most of them are African, like, African-African. But, like, you know, Chadwick Boseman is African-American, Michael B. Jordan is African-American. Like, a lot of the people actually making the movie, that's, like, the perspective. And there's something really fascinating about that, because I think that's what a lot of the movie is sort of diving into is, as you said, like, it's that relationship, this weird sort of broken relationship, broken by slavery from your ancestral tradition in Africa, and trying to navigate that connection and what that means.
Because I think one of the most powerful things about the movie, and I find this powerful as, you know, a white guy in this scenario, a privileged white guy. I can't imagine for, you know, black audiences of all ages, I think, what is in this film. But what I find so powerful is in that world building and all it does in Wakanda, and what is both imagined and cool and fantastical, but also what is very rooted in African culture. And there's a lot of intersection there because a lot of how the, it's a fantasy built out of African culture, not out of like, you know, the same kind of sci-fi we've been seeing since Kubrick's, you know, 2001 or something, right?
Yeah.
It's not that kind of sci-fi. And there is such vibrancy to that culture. And to connect that as the heritage it is building upon and showing how much pride there is and should be, but also, of course, that pride has been denied to people like the Michael B. Jordan character, who that's his part of his whole argument in the movie is that, you know, in Wakanda, you guys get to have this pride in this amazing culture and heritage you have. And in America, I don't get to have that pride because it's kind of drummed out of us. Yeah. And I think that alone is such a powerful idea. And then, of course, as you say, where it goes in the final couple of scenes of how it chooses to bring all that home, quite literally back to the American context of, again, the POV of the filmmakers, is, I think, a really amazing thing. And so this is one of those movies where any part of it you kind of push on, you get into deep textual stuff. Because there's nothing here that's just for flashiness. Although, when it's flashy, it's fucking flashy.
Yeah. Like because you were, like, when you were sort of, like, listing all the, like, visual elements of the movie that the movie is superb about, the one that sticks out to me so strongly is the costume design.
So
like,
good.
There are not a lot of movies that I see. I think, feel like, we maybe talked about this on, like, the Academy Award podcast or something, or, like, when that was happening, of, like a lot of those kinds of rewards of, like, makeup design, that kind of stuff. It's hard to watch a movie and, like, for me, at least, know that's like, oh, this is a movie that's so excellent in that category. This is a movie that's like, this should be up for fucking the Costume Design Academy Award. Because it's everything. It's the superhero stuff. It's the African, like, Wakanda, Afrofuturism stuff. And it's also, like, just, like, for me, when it really stuck out was when they were in South Korea at the Bai, and it's, like, they're wearing, like, normal, sort of, like, fancy clothes. And even that's, like, the fucking costume design is so good. Like, every single character in this movie is, like, the sexiest person in the world. Like, and a huge part of that thing is the costume design is so good.
Yeah.
Like, every single scene, every single character looks so fucking good.
Well, and as someone who really does love, like, the crafts side and pays a lot of attention to that, it is just an absolute smorgasbord. And I think next year at the Oscars, costume design for Black Panther should be the most obvious gimme award in the history of the Oscars, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. Like, and this is Ruth E. Carter did the costume design. And I did recognize her name because she has definitely won an Oscar before for costume design. She's been in the industry forever. I mean, I just looked up her page. Like, one of the first things they show is Malcolm X, you know, from 1992. Okay, yeah. Like, she's been doing this a long time, and she's really good at this. And one of many women behind the scenes also that do phenomenal work here. Like, so many great female performances in front of the camera, and so much great craftsmanship from women behind the camera. Because Ryan Coogler, and this is true of all of his films, hires a lot more women for positions that are often filled by men than a lot of male directors. Like, costume design is fairly typically a female-driven field. But, like, the cinematographer here is, I think her name is Rachel Morrison. Rachel Morrison is the director of photography. You don't see a lot of female DPs on big Hollywood movies, and she is so talented. That's great. Debbie Berman is one of the two editors on this. You know, like, there's just Hannah Beechler was the production designer. Just those names I want to celebrate, because, again, some of those are roles that are not frequently filled by women, and every one of those should, at the very least, be an Oscar contender next year.
Yeah,
you know? But yeah, those costumes, like, I think maybe the best showcase set piece in the film, just for all the craftsmanship, is probably the coronation fight scene.
Yeah, I was thinking
where they're
as well.
They're on the cliffs, and he gets his. It's a setup for something later in the movie. We later find out. Although if it had not come back, it's still just a great scene on its own, where T'Challa gets his powers taken away from him, and then he has to fight.
Yeah, but you have the representatives of all the different tribes, because you have, like, it looks like the elder from each of the tribes, and then, like, they're like best warrior or something standing next to them and all saying, like, we will not challenge today.
Yep, and you have those, like, big, like, you know, these, like, Wakandan, you know, stadium, like, seating or something with all the people standing there, and there's those big sweeping shots of just all the people there watching the coronation from all the tribes, and there's just so many amazing costumes there, and then just, like, the CGI on imagining, like, the landscapes of Wakanda and everything, and that's also where the music is doing all these, like, African drum beats, and it's so great. But yeah, that's one of those scenes where just everything comes together and it feels so singular because there's just not another major $200 million Hollywood movie that looks like this.
Yeah.
You know, there have, as people were noting, like, there were some really dumb headlines in the last couple weeks of, like, Black Panther is the first superhero movie with black people. And it's like, do a Google search, you stupid motherfuckers. Yeah. It's not. What is accurate to say is it's the first one that is made this thoroughly and on this scale from a black perspective with black talent in front of and behind the camera. And that is significant, but there's also nuance to that.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Let us not forget Steel.
Let's not forget Steel.
Starring Shaquille O'Neal.
Yes, or Blade is probably the better example, but yes.
There's also that one. But Wesley Snipes and Blade does not rhyme. Steel and Shaquille O'Neal does.
Absolutely, it does. All right. But anyway, yeah. So what else about the production design? Like, I just love, like, in terms of the world building, that's, you know, once you get back to Wakanda after the first couple of scenes, just what they do in terms of all the steps of his coronation, which take you through all these pieces of the Wakandan culture, it's just, if you are into, like, fantasy sci-fi world building, it is, like, heaven to watch this.
Yeah.
Because I love seeing, like, the Wakandan streets and how it is this interesting mixture of, like, you know, how we think of, like, futuristic technological societies from a more African and African-American perspective. All of that's interesting and amazing. And then you get into, like, the castle, and it's such cool sets and everything. And there's all the costumes. And then you go underground, and there's all the vibranium mines. And you meet his sister, who is the most awesome character in the world. And she's just making all these cool inventions, and I love learning about all of that. And I love all the stuff about, especially when you get to, after his coronation, then he has to go get buried and drink the heart-shaped herb. Is that it, right?
Yeah.
Drink the heart-shaped herb. Again, like, 10 years ago, there is a detail that would not have been in the Black Panther film adaptation, is the magical heart-shaped herb that takes him to the ancestral plane.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. And then the ancestral plane is such a cool thing. Like, before you even meet the villain of the movie, you have seen such a cool piece of world building. I wrote this on Twitter. It feels like Wakanda has been in, like, 10 movies before, but this is the first one it's been in. It's amazing.
Yeah. No, it is utterly astounding. And it is something that, like, part of it is also how fresh it feels, because it is coming from this different sort of visual language. That is something that has been, you know, like, this is not the first example of Afrofuturism in art, but it is, like, the first I know of in certainly it must be the first of, like, major blockbuster films, but in, like, film in general, I don't know of any other movies that have this sort of basic aesthetic. But it's something that's, like, in visual art, or like described in novels, like the Wind Up Girl by, I can't remember the name, but there's this really good sci-fi novel called The Wind Up Girl that, like, has describes some stuff like this, and the cover art sort of shows cities that kind of have a similar kind of Afrofuturistic aesthetic. But this is, like, that done on such a grand, resplendent scale with, you know, the weight of Disney behind it from their, like, Star Wars hoard. And they give some of that money. It's like, here you go. Like, make this fucking awesome African feature city.
I mean, this is part of why the movie works, and kudos to Marvel for it, is they didn't go cheap on Black Panther. You know, they didn't say, like, we're going to do our test run of, like, you get $100 million to do Black Panther. This is a full-on $200 million movie.
Yeah.
You know? And that's awesome because, again, getting to play on that size of a canvas with this kind of artistic foundation is a really amazing thing. Because, yeah, a lot of these basic visual ideas obviously have existed for decades and centuries and whatnot, but seeing them in this combination on this scale, on this canvas, is a really meaningful and exciting and just thrilling thing to see up there on the screen, you know? Yeah. And again, it's also just done, like, take all the, like, uniqueness out of it. I think it's just done with a level of artistic skill and precision and follow-through that is pretty superior to anything Marvel's done. I think, like, in terms of visual design, the Guardians of the Galaxy movies and Thor Ragnarok are up there, but I would say they're a tier or two below this in terms of overall effects and, like,
and it mostly, like those movies don't, like Guardians never sticks in one place long enough to sort of, like, fully flesh out that setting, and Thor Ragnarok, like, sticks in, I forget what it's called, but, you know, like, the sort of, like, the Driftwood world or whatever for longer than Guardians ever stays in one place, but even then it has to move to Asgard and stuff. And Asgard is a relatively well-realized world, but that's after having three movies set there, you know?
Absolutely. And I would also say that there's a distinction I would make here between, I think, like, the Thor movies, the Guardians movies, Doctor Strange. Those are movies with great production design and great visual effects and very good, competent, well-done cinematography, but I don't think they are cinematographically, whatever I'm trying to say.
Cinematographically.
Cinematographically, like, super profound, interesting works. I do think Black Panther is more of a fusion of those things, where it is great special effects and great production design, but I also think Rachel Morrison's photography is just particularly smart and interesting, and like how she frames things and how a lot of shots just have not just grandeur to them, but there are a lot of more intimate shots that just, in how things are framed and how shots are aligned, there's a lot more artistry to it than I think you typically see in a movie of this scale, whether it's from Marvel or a different studio, you know?
Yeah.
So all of that goes into it. But yeah, it is in service of telling a great story with great characters, of course. And that's what we need to talk about.
Yes.
One of the things I do find interesting is Black Panther has a kind of weird plot structure. It's one that works great.
It's particularly unconventional for a superhero movie.
Yeah, because it kind of in its first half has sort of a James Bond-esque plot structure.
Yeah.
Where you have like the opening mission, and then he goes back and kind of talks with what is his status quo, but here it's not MI6, you know, it's Wakanda. Yeah. And his Q is his awesome little sister Shuri, who has just the coolest inventions and the best personality.
Yeah.
And can also drive a car remotely, and that's pretty neat. And then like there's a mystery they have to go solve, and so you go out to some exotic location, in this case South Korea, and they have kind of a spy sequence which goes into a big car chase, which is so good, and we'll talk about that. And only after all of that do you really meet the main villain who comes into the fray. That's a very James Bond-esque plot structure.
Yeah.
Like, in the skeleton, not in any of how they fill in the details, really, but skeletally it is. And then, once Michael B. Jordan comes in, I think he has one scene early on, but once he's like a consistent
part... Yeah, he has the art scene is earlier.
Yeah, yeah, which is so good. But like once you... I should stop saying that. All the scenes in this movie are good. We should just follow that. But once he comes into the movie proper as like a consistent character there, it really does have this shift where things kind of snap into place. And I forget which scene it is. I think it's when Michael B. Jordan's Killmonger comes to Wakanda and like presents himself to the throne room when he starts talking about how like... You know, our brothers and sisters live in bondage and abuse all over the world, and you do nothing to help them, that I realize, like, oh, that's the story they're telling.
Yeah.
And once the movie, I think, starts to play its hand of, like, we had to do a lot of this to get to this point, and it was all very good, but now we're telling the actual story, and that story is more interesting even than what the kind of first hour of the movie hints at, you know?
Yeah, but they do set it up because they do a couple of things. Because the movie has like a really interesting, kind of complicated opening of where you have the the prologue or something of that you have that scene set in Oakland in 1992, where you have all the kids in the street playing basketball with like the basket, like the literal basket for the hoop.
Yep.
And then you sort of, over the course of that scene, you realize, okay, like, what we're looking at is the brother to T'Chaka, the previous king who dies, like, halfway through Captain America Civil War, and you kind of, like, play through all that scenario, and that kind of sets up something, and then you cut to T'Challa in the present day, meeting up, it was sort of, like, I guess, extracting the love interest character who's a secret, like, spy lady, war dog is what they call them, who's embedded in, like, what looks like human trafficking or something. And with that, they kind of start setting up more directly that the tension that they kind of put to the side a little bit with the Andy Serkis Ulysses Claw plot line, which is this the isolationism of Wakanda and what that means and whether or not that's the right thing to be. And T'Challa, being in this position of being the new king, has to make a choice of whether or not he's going to follow tradition and follow what the ancestors have typically done, which is hide Wakanda away, hide them from the world, don't interfere with everybody else. It's kind of like Wonder Woman in some ways. And say like, you know, the world of men / the world of white people is not our issue. But also like the issues of the rest of Africa is not really our issue. We do a couple things here. We have a couple of war dogs out. But we are isolationist and we are fine where we are. And then, do you remember what the Love Interest character's name is?
Yeah, Nakia.
Nakia, thank you, because I couldn't remember.
I also have IMDb in front of me, okay, so
I'm not... That will be helpful.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is because I hate having to refer to a character as, like, Love Interest character, but it's the only... If I can't remember the character name, it's the only thing I have fallback
on. And she is much more than that. This is not, like, Natalie Portman in Thor.
Exactly, yeah. But, yeah, so Nakia, like, is in that position of saying, like, no, like, there's more we can do. I have been out here, and I have seen the suffering, and I know the power that Wakanda has access to, and I know that we can do more. And I love that the movie sort of like puts that issue in your mind at the beginning and like sort of puts that in front of T'Challa, and then he gets sidetracked with this Ulysses Claw thing for a little bit, and then like that problem comes back home to roost, and then you get the prologue scene back and see the full everything that happened, and it starts complicating those layers further and further and further.
And that's what I mean about when the movie plays its hand, because it's like, yeah, you know what cards are out there. It's when they put them together in the specific like organization of what Killmonger's argument is, what happened with Killmonger's father and T'Challa's father, and now the decisions T'Challa has to make. That's when it becomes fully just electric. Like, that's when things are really profound and interesting. But it is motivated because all those earlier things have to happen. And the movie winds up really getting to have its cake and eating it too, as like a spy superhero movie that's super fun and stylish and cool, but also, you know, very smart and very profound in the things it has to say, and it doesn't have to sacrifice one to have the other.
Yeah, it's really awesome. And one of the things I also love about this, and it's one of the things that sort of proves to me that there are advantages to the way that Marvel operates, and like the cinematic universe, the idea has advantageous components to it that a lot of people, I think, too readily dismiss, mm-hmm. which is T'Challa being introduced in Civil War gives this movie so many tools it can run with, and then it makes all the right choices. It's the same thing that Spider-Man Homecoming had, that having that Spider-Man introduced in Civil War in a smaller role did like help that movie so much. I think Black Panther has helped tremendously by not having to go into the weeds about like who is Black Panther, like who's his dad, like what is the situation, like who are these people. Like, you can assume that the audience has a basic familiarity with some of that, like, basic stuff, so that this movie doesn't feel like it's a Black Panther origin movie. We got the Black Panther origin movie. It was Captain America Civil War. And this gets to be, like, the sequel that goes harder in on the real issues and doesn't have to spend the whole movie just setting up the main hero. It gets to spend the whole movie complicating the main hero's worldview, not just establishing it.
It's a huge boon, and I was thinking that throughout, too, which is, like... And even before I saw the movie, just going into it, like, there really is an advantage of Marvel being able to launch, you know, slightly more obscure properties like a Black Panther, which is definitely, like, it's more famous than some, like a Guardians of the Galaxy or something, but it's not quite as, well, it's a household name for black people and stuff, but not maybe for white audiences and other parts of America, but, like... being able to just have this platform where you have this many movies and that kind of financial security and a big series where like you can give the resources to Black Panther because you have enough other things going on and you can trust people will come see it because the Marvel brand is there as well.
And that knows that people love Chadwick Boseman in Captain America Civil War, so they like that character has already sold. You already know that works.
Yep, and it just means you get to hit the ground running here. There's no baggage that this movie is carrying in with it. And even the things that like... You know, like Ryan Coogler didn't get to cast Chadwick Boseman or Martin Freeman or Andy Serkis and, you know, did have to come into this movie and do something with all of those elements. But it doesn't feel like a weight on the movie. It feels like, I mean, one, I would be very thankful if someone cast Chadwick Boseman for me in a movie I got to make. I'd be like, that's great. I wouldn't cast anyone else. That's perfect. Yeah.
And if you have to have two white dudes in your movie, fucking Andy Serkis and Martin Freeman are two pretty good white dudes to have, right?
Yes, and they actually work... I was actually... The one thing I was maybe worried about going in is like... Will it feel kind of forced that they have to bring in the Andy Serkis character from Avengers, because he was in Age of Ultron, is where he loses the arm, and then Martin Freeman's from Civil War, like, are they going to need that? Because sometimes that does happen, where, like, there's a character introduced in a different Marvel movie, and then when the full movie comes, it's like, it doesn't feel like the new director is, like, really wanted to use that character.
Yeah, and that's kind of, like... Then you say, Natalie Portman, you don't have to be in these movies anymore.
Yes, that's pretty much it. But, like, there's none of that in Black Panther. It really feels like all the things that were seeded in Civil War work really well here, up to and including just the basic incident of what motivates T'Challa going into this film, which is that he just saw his father killed, and now he has to become the king. Like, You know, because if you had to do that all in this movie, you'd have to have a whole extra first act.
Yeah, you'd have to get rid of the Ulysses Claw first act and replace it with T'Chaka dying.
Yeah, and that would just, it would be way too much of a drain. Like, coming in with this movie with T'Challa as his own character, and that those things happened, but they don't have to be part of this story. It's the fallout of that that becomes this story. That's just so much more interesting.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that's been, I think, a pretty consistent thing in a lot of these Phase 3 things, is that part of the value of, like, the team-up movies, whether it's Age of Ultron or Civil War, is that they kind of get to clean house for the main movies, and now, like, the standalones don't have to do any of that shit anymore. Like, I just remember back in Phase 1, there are a lot of elements in, like, Iron Man 2 and Thor and even the first Avenger, Captain America, that feel, if you go back to them, like, kind of labored in that they have to set up a lot of things so we can get to Avengers. And there were a lot of that in Phase 2 as well in some of the movies, like all the stuff with the Infinity Stones and Guardians of the Galaxy 1.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't have to do that at all anymore, you know? Like, I actually remember a lot of people were theorizing, oh, we're going to see the last Infinity Stone is in Wakanda in this movie. And I think Marvel has just made the decision, like, we'll deal with the Infinity Stones in the Infinity Stones movies. Ryan Coogler, don't worry about it. Just whatever story you want to tell, that's fine.
Yeah.
We have to do one thing with Bucky, that'll be after the credits.
Exactly. You know,
that's all there is. And it's just, it's very freeing. It's actually, obviously, there is a commercial component to this where they also, it's a marketing thing where Civil War makes it easier to sell Black Panther, but it also, I just think, makes the movie better. So,
yeah, because, you know, superhero movies in particular have these, like, and not just superhero movies, like, the superhero genre has these tropes with the origin story that, like, are so cumbersome from a storytelling point of view that it is just, like, it was just one of the things that I remember thinking, like, 30 minutes into the movie of, like, this movie feels really fresh for a lot of reasons. And then, like, I was, like, my subconscious process, like, going through the layers. And then I hit that one layer. I was like, oh, right. Like, I think it was around the time because they showed a flashback from Civil War of T'Chaka dying. It's like, that's just such an elegant way to just have to deal with this bullshit. Like, you can just have that be done. And you don't have to spend 30 minutes explaining the character and the backstory.
And also, if we go back to Civil War, all of those things made Civil War better because those are good parts and essential parts of the story. And I'm really excited to go watch Civil War again because I remember Chadwick Boseman being one of the best parts of that movie. He has that final scene where he confronts the villain, the Daniel Brühl character.
Yeah, brings him up.
Yeah, and the decisions he makes there, thinking at first he's going to kill him because this is the guy who killed his father, and then deciding, like, this guy is too broken for me to do that. I just need to arrest him. And, like, him putting, like, the Black Panther helmet down and everything. He's so good in that movie. And I feel like it's going to be even better next time I watch it, because now I've had a movie where I really know T'Challa.
Yeah.
And that's just cool. And then we're going to get Infinity War, and he's probably going to be one of the best parts of that.
Yes, and we get to go back to Wakanda and get bearded Captain America and T'Challa hanging out, and I'm very excited about, like, and it's one of the other things that, like, I want to talk about some of the other characters. One of the things that's so much fun about watching these Marvel movies is getting the characters and then thinking about, like, I desperately, desperately, desperately need a scene with Shuri and Ned, the guy in the chair from Spider-Man Homecoming. I need those two people to meet.
That'd be great.
I need the people in the chair to meet. I need it to happen so bad.
I love that because the obvious one there would be her and Tony Stark because they're inventors.
Yeah, that could be a fun scene.
That could be fun, but no, you're totally right. Ned would be so much more fun there.
It's like, it's just, it is one of the great blessings of Black Panther is that it has, like, I love T'Challa. I think he's a great character. I've always liked Black Panther, T'Challa as a character from the comics because it's like that, like, superhero who has to be a superhero and a king is such a cool fucking idea. Mm-hmm. That's like, and that's one of the things that sets this movie apart is that they 100% deal with that. And it's something that, like, the Thor movies and the Thor character toys with sometimes, but his whole thing is that he doesn't want to be king at all. Yeah. T'Challa has no choice. Like, he has to be king. He is the king. So it's like that. I always love the T'Challa character, and I like they've represented him so well in Civil War in this movie. But then also you just have this great fucking cast of just amazing characters, and my favorite character might be Shuri.
Yes. Let's talk about the other characters in a second. Let's start with Black Panther, though, because I do have one other thing to say about T'Challa, which is T'Challa belongs, though, to this larger archetype for superheroes that I really love, which is the superhero who is super responsible.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that more than the powers makes him super, is that he's just a responsible dude that you look up to because he is thoughtful and responsible in his or her role. I like that. And that's the thing when people say, like, Superman is a boring character. That's what's interesting about Superman is the morality, like being moral and making the decision to be moral is not boring. It's difficult.
Yeah.
And it's hard, and it is a real struggle that feels inspirational and earned because it's a good thing to fight for. And just as recently as last week, I saw someone tweet out an article about another person saying, like, clearly, like, the DC movies have proven Superman just, he's a 20th century character. We can't have him in the 21st century. And it's like, fuck you. That one, that's not even Superman in those movies.
Yeah.
But two, like, we've had a lot of these kind of characters lately. Captain America is one of those.
Yep.
Wonder Woman absolutely is one of those in her movie. And T'Challa is one of those here. And those are all very different flavors of that. And I like that, you know, you have like, you know, white guy Captain America, white woman Wonder Woman, black guy Black Panther here, you know, so it's kind of different flavors of it in terms of gender and race and origin as well. But like, I think those kind of character archetypes are super interesting. Like I was... In the class I'm TAing for at CU Boulder, we just watched To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes,
and
yeah.
I was struck again by, it's easy to like, the stereotype of like Atticus Finch is a great character and all that. Watch that movie again. What Gregory Peck does in showing the vulnerability of trying to be that good a person, it's not easy for him. It's a real struggle. Like Atticus has a lot on his plate just trying to be a good guy in a small town, and that's what makes the movie compelling. It's not that like he is tempted by the dark side. It's that he's trying to be good, and he can't always win.
Yeah.
And I think that adapts very easily into a superhero setting, and I do think it's probably the most compelling thing about T'Challa here. It doesn't make him as flashy as some of the other characters. He doesn't get to be funny in the way, like, Shuri is funny.
Yeah.
Although he has some little moments where he's very... Yes. Chadwick Boseman does some good dry delivery, I think. But it does, I do think his arc through the movie of... He knows he has to be king. He wants to be a good king. He only has the interest of doing the right thing in mind. But doing the right thing isn't always easy, and it's not always clear. And that is compelling. And it's something Chadwick Boseman plays compellingly. And so the most interesting things Black Panther does isn't getting in the cool cat suit and fighting people. It's the moments where he has to make the decisions about, you know, what do I do about Killmonger? How do I come back from this thing that's happened to me midway through the movie where I've been dethroned, you know? When I have Killmonger near the end where he manages to get the fatal blow in on him, how do I deal with this guy now that I've finished this? All of those are kinds of character beats that, you know, Batman doesn't get to have.
Yeah.
Like, the dark, gritty superheroes don't get to have those moments that feel to me very human.
Yeah, and it's something that I love. The movie has that line in the first sort of vision in the ancestral plane where his dad tells him, like, you are a good man, and it is hard for a good man to be a king. And yeah. And that's, like, you know, one of the sort of first lines that really sets up the conflict T'Challa has to run into, which is that he is cut from that sort of, like, Boy Scout superhero cloth. You know, he is that, like straight up, like, upstanding moral person that is always going to strive to do the upstanding moral thing and doesn't, you know, like, he's not gritty, he's not dark, he's not that kind of, like, 90s bullshit superhero archetype. Like, he knows, or, like, once he finds out and decides on what the right thing is to do, which is, like, what is the most compassionate and heartful thing to do, he goes and he does that thing, which is a hard, like, stance to take in one's life when one is also the ruler of a nation.
And mistakes do stem from it. Like, he's not a perfect character in this movie. Like, in fact, his whole, like, fun spy adventure in the first act is probably a mistake in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Because it leaves Wakanda undefended, and it leaves him open to things he didn't expect to happen.
Yeah, and basically every single one of his advisors are sitting there saying, like, you shouldn't do this. Like, you literally just became king, like, 10 minutes ago, dog. Like, don't leave your fucking kingdom to go on a cool James Bond spy mission. I know you have a super suit, and I know you have superpowers, but, like, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. Unfortunately, you didn't have a dead uncle that told you that shit yet. And so, yeah, he instead listens to his friend who has been, you know, touched by the darkness of Ulysses' claw and wants this sort of mission of revenge and goes with it on that mind and isn't thinking about what is best for his people.
Yes. The character played by Daniel Kaluuya.
Yes.
From Get Out.
Yeah.
Oscar nominee Daniel Kaluuya. How cool is that?
Yeah. It took me the longest time to, like, look at this, like, yeah, I just saw a movie with this guy. What the fuck was it?
And I didn't see it until the end credits, and it was the whole movie. I'm like, I know this guy. And I think part of it is everyone is so chameleonic in this movie and falling into, like, their roles and the costumes and the voice. It's like, even like Lupita Nyong'o plays Nakia. I've seen her in a million things. I knew it was her, but it's like, they just so become the characters.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, okay, so that character's cool, but we should talk about the women.
Yes.
The main, I guess, three or four, because you also have the mother,
yeah,
are all best, so yeah. great. So you've got, let me read that. So you have Denai Gurira, I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing that right, as Okoye, the general,
yeah.
who is, like, maybe the biggest badass in the Marvel Universe now.
It's yeah, she does that thing with the spear and the car.
Yeah.
Pretty fucking cool.
Pretty fucking cool. Lupita Nyong'o as Nakia. She's great. Letitia Wright is Shuri. And I was also, like, when I saw her name in the credits, I'm like, I keep hearing of that name. What is it? And I realized it was just hype about her in this performance because I think people in the industry knew she was going to be this good.
Yeah.
But this is, like, I think her big film debut, and she's so amazing. And then, of course, Angela Bassett as the mother, who is named Ramonda. I don't know if that's said in the movie, but I see the name there. Just so many good female characters, and that core trio, especially of the people who kind of help T'Challa directly, are such amazing characters.
Yeah, no, it's something, and there's something weird about it. I had this thought like halfway through the movie. There's something weirdly anime about it, of the like when you break it down to its essentials of like main male character who has like this badass like. Lady bodyguard who's, you know, like his sort of like close friend, and then the super cool spy lady, and then his little sister who's like, the little sister is the one that nails it, of the little sister who jokes around with you that is also like a genius inventing like super weapons in the basement. Like, that's such an anime fucking set of characters. It's like,
and
you just usually, and it's one of the things of that, you know, I think there are, it's not all like great gender representation in anime, but there is something a lot of times really interesting about the representation of female characters in anime, and sort of like otaku style storytelling that gives them really privileged roles in stories. Again, there's a lot of complicated stuff to unravel with that, but it's something that like a lot of Western fiction typically does not do. Like a lot of Western fiction typically has like you are the girlfriend character, you are the mom, and like those are the two characters you get. Like that's it. And it's like, maybe the girlfriend character is kind of cool, or maybe the mom character is kind of cool, but that's about as far as it goes. And it's like, you don't get the sort of like more colorful, interesting characters like genius baby sister that is like Q. Yeah. But like the best Q there's ever been.
Yeah, and you know, that's probably a conscious influence for Ryan Coogler. He's a 31-year-old American. Like,
yeah.
He must watch anime. He's not that much older than us. Like, yeah. He definitely grew up with all those influences, I guess. It's one of the exciting things about Black Panther, I think, is it's got a lot of interesting influences rattling around inside of it. And some are ones that are more commonly drawn upon in Hollywood. Some are much less commonly drawn upon in Hollywood. Like, you know, African Senegalese filmmaking, which you have a lot of like visual signifiers of, but then you also have like, I totally think the anime thing is probably conscious to some degree, because you're absolutely right, especially Shuri. She feels like an animated character almost in just how bubbling off the screen she is.
Yeah.
It's such a great character.
Yeah. And for me, like, I think one of the reasons why I really latch onto the Shuri character is that I think the moment I really fell in love with the movie was when T'Challa goes into the basement for the first time before he's going on his mission, and you have the Q scene, which is, I have not seen every James Bond movie, but of the ones I have seen, this is the best Q scene I've seen in any movie of like that, or like parodies of it in other movies, or like not necessarily parodies, but like other takes on the gadget scene with the genius person who made the gadget. And it is specifically the moment when he walks down and she's explaining some of the stuff, and then she just goes, "And what the hell are those?" And it's like, "Oh, do you like my royal sandals?" And he puts the royal sandals up, and it's like, and then they have the whole thing with like the sneakers and the sneaker joke. And it's just like, they so sold this sibling relationship and this warmth and heart to it, and the humor that is something that like this movie is one of them, probably the most, other than like Guardians 2 gets pretty fucking dark, but like one of the most dour Marvel movies, but it, where it finds the humor in it is in those like really human moments. And that was the one that like really sold that, like it sold that relationship. And I think one of the things that really sold me was this other side of T'Challa, your main character, that's like, we've seen so much of the like get business done, super serious, like I am the king / like in Civil War, like I'm on a revenge mission. You've seen that side of T'Challa. What you didn't get to see so much is him joking around with his baby sister and playing around with his dumb sandals and shit.
And I think Chadwick Boseman, one of the things he does well here is he's a very giving actor. here. He's totally willing to kind of step aside in a lot of scenes and let Letitia Wright or Lupita Nyong'o or any of the other co-stars he has kind of steal the scene from him. But when he's there, kind of like Shuri is definitely the gravity center of that scene because of the energy she has. But I love how much Bozeman kind of modulates the energy he has in different scenes between like when he's like on the cliffside doing the big fight and he has the thing of like, I am Prince T'Challa, son of, you know, that whole thing is like great. But that's a very different, you know, that's his like kingly energy. And then when he's with his sister, he's totally relaxed and he seems 10 years younger because he doesn't have to be anything with her.
Yeah, he other just than, needs to be himself. He doesn't have to be the king.
Yeah. Or like in scenes with the Lupita Nyong'o character, his love interest, like what's interesting about those, one of the things I really like with Nakia is that it's not like they meet cute in this movie and then like fall in love over the course of it. It's that they have had probably a relationship since childhood or something. And it's gone on a long time.
She's the childhood friend character. Again, going back to the anime, you have the childhood friend, the little sister, and the tsundere, like, military lady. Like, it's all anime. it's like the deeper you dig in, it's anime. It's all I'm saying.
Yes, but I like here that it's a very, like, they are both adults now. They have adult responsibilities. They clearly have feelings for each other. But it's not, like, heat-of-the-moment stuff. And it's interesting how that kind of mature relationship, tinged with the sadness of, like, something at some point went wrong between them. And we don't even have to have the specifics. All of those things, like, there's a lot of good modulations he does, like, bouncing between all these larger-than-life characters.
Yeah, and talking about, like, the Naki character more specifically, like, I think she is, of that trio, the least interesting, because she's, like, the one that's given the least sort of, like, flashy role. But I do really like that, you know, they have a love interest character, but it's not just that, like, the bullshit Natalie Portman in Thor kind of like, well, we have to have a love interest, so we will throw it in there kind of role. I like that she is so tied in with, like, the core theme of the movie, which is, as we talked about, like, in that the first, like, kind of moment she gets is she is the one who sets up for T'Challa, like, Wakanda needs to change. There are things that we can do to be better, and he is resistant to that, and, like multiple times sort of asserts that while he understands where she's coming from, he is going to kind of follow on the path that has been laid for him. And that ultimately, like, the reason, either that they, like, get back together and are married necessarily, but, like, they kind of, like, reconcile and are back together in some way by the end of the movie is that he has come to see how right she was and come to her side. And, like, that's interesting. That's, like, a lot more compelling than just, like, you know, the kind of, like, girlfriend is, like, the reward for saving the day kind of thing, which so many superhero movies fall into.
Yes, like, you know, the Mary Jane trope of, like, the Kirsten Dunst Mary Jane worked when Sam Raimi did it in, like, 2001.
Yeah.
I think, like, the Thor movies proved pretty definitively you cannot do that anymore to the same... especially if you move outside of the very specific comic book-y tone Sam Raimi had that I think allows that to largely, but not entirely, work.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like you're totally right. And her having things to teach T'Challa and that he can come around to those matters, because it's an interesting thing that I actually think Marvel generally does this well, in that they make superheroes who have to learn on their adventures, and they are not just uniquely empowered with all wisdom and everything. Right. They actually have to come around to discover things. And he has a lot in here, where it's not like he has terrible ideas for leading. He's a very noble person, but there are things about the world that he, you know, other people have, like Nakia has kind of the less violent version of this, but obviously Killmonger has this too, about what that isolationism means and the cost of that, and that grappling with it, again, just a very powerful thing for that character to go through, but also means that the supporting cast is empowered to be a much more interesting set of players than they usually are in this kind of film.
Yeah.
So yeah. Also, just Okoye is so cool. I had not really seen this actress before, I think, Denai Gurira. I think she plays Michonne in The Walking Dead, is what I saw.
I believe that is correct.
Okay, I'm seeing that on her IMDb. Oh, she's in Infinity War. Okay, great.
Yes.
I just saw that. So I don't know if I had seen her in that, in something before. She is so good. Like, just screen presence and just the sheer badassery of it. But then, like, there are also some, like, so you have that scene, like, in the car chase where she does the thing with the spear and stops the car, and it's amazing, and everyone in the theater claps. But there's also just moments, like, later on when she has her own kind of dramatic things to grapple with in terms of what's her loyalty to Wakanda versus her loyalty to T'Challa, and she plays some of those scenes just really dramatically powerfully. And I totally want her to kind of get her own Marvel movie or something at this point.
Yes, yeah.
She's a great hero.
Yeah, and it is something that, again, like it's because she's like a really interesting character and is like kind of weird and cool. And I love all the shit in South Korea where she has to wear the wig and she's like, I made this stuff, like pulls this fucking spear out, starts kicking ass, like all that stuff's awesome. She like in the action scenes, she's fantastic. But yeah, one of like the scene that really stands out for her for me is that scene after Killmonger has usurped the throne and she and Nakia are alone in like T'Challa's sort of office or whatever at night and Nakia's like, come on, let's go, and she's like, I can't. Like I can't betray the throne. Like, I am loyal to the throne. That's what I am. And then by the end of the movie, she has to sort of realize what is, you know, like, part and parcel to a lot of the core themes of that is, like, it's not about the... It's almost kind of like Thor Ragnarok was saying. It's like, it's not about the fucking... It's not about the place. It's not about the nation. It's about the people. It's about the compassion. It's about what's right. It's not about the throne. It's about the guy who sits on the throne who's the good person. Like, the good man who sits on that throne, not the guy who comes in and is trying to murder everybody and, like, murdered that guy who was sitting on the throne instead of trying to work things through. Like, it is... Like her having to go on that small little journey gives her this function in the plot that is more than just being a cool supporting character. And it's something that, like, this whole movie, top to bottom, like, epitomizes both, like, this really effective functionalism that, like, it just, on the basic plot character level, like, movie-making level, it is rock-fucking-solid, and then it has all the flashy stuff on top of it and all the colorful stuff on top of it.
Yeah, she's also just so good with, like, the physicality of the fight scenes. Yeah. Because, again, outside of, like, dedicated martial artists, and I don't know if she is a dedicated martial artist in real life or something, but, because I think Michonne is a similar role with, like, sword play and stuff, but, like, you don't typically get people using a thing like a bow staff or a spear that well in a movie. She's really good with it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that mixture is of stunt work and the performer or whatever, but whenever she whips out the spear and is fighting, it's like, this is going to be good.
Yeah.
It also just frequently, like, those sorts of things give the action sequences a very different energy than they have in other Marvel movies. There is, luckily in Black Panther, there is no glowing doodad on a roof they have to go stop.
Right,
there's
yeah.
none of that what's... There is, like, they have to stop the ships from leaving the thing, but, like, although that's mostly left to the Martin Freeman character.
Yeah, and that's, like, way more grounded than, like magic beams shooting up to the sky that's making all the clouds yes. go around, like, Justice League and every other fucking comic
movie. It's literally every DC movie.
Yeah.
It's several Marvel movies. But, yeah, there's none of that. And a lot of it is much more sort of intimate, small-scale stuff. And they're all different. Like, you have the kind of spy movie car chase in the middle versus the big sort of war scene at the end versus some of the hand-to-hand combat things going on. And even within fight scenes, like the one at the end of the film, it's like three or four very different action sequences all cut together.
Yeah.
And so wherever you cut to, it feels fresh and interesting and nothing overstays its welcome.
Yeah.
But yeah, getting back to the characters, just again to mention Angela Bassett as the mother.
Yeah.
Really love her. I mean, if you want to get a character who is going to play a warm, wise, awesome matriarch, you can't do much better than Angela Bassett.
Yeah.
She's great. I think she gets some really good moments. I'd love to see even more from that character at some point.
Yeah.
But I think she's very, very good with what they give her to play and has some of the best costumes.
Yes, yeah.
You know, which is no small thing in this movie.
Uh-huh.
Yep. You want to talk about the two white characters before we
sure.
get back to some of the main principles?
Yes, yeah. Which one do you want to tackle first?
Andy Serkis. It is such... Andy Serkis does not get to be himself enough in movies.
Uh-huh.
And it's not like I complain about the amount of mocap he does, because when he does mocap, you get like Caesar in Planet of the Apes, and it's amazing and groundbreaking, and he is pushing the medium forward. But I do so whenever I see him in person without the mocap, I remember it's like, right, he is just such a great actor with or without that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he also doesn't really get to talk much in Planet of the Apes. He's got such a great voice, and he's just a really fun, slimy, like, James Bond henchman in this.
Yeah, and it's something of that he had that really brief sequence in Avengers 2, which felt like, why the fuck did you get Andy Serkis to do this? Like, I get, like, I understand the references. I've read a couple of comic books. I know what Wakanda is. I know what a vibranium is. But why would you just throw fucking Andy Serkis into this, like, weird little role for, like, 10 minutes in this movie? And then it finally feels like, you know, he gets a good chunk of this movie to just be weird in Andy Serkis. And there was something that I saw a really good point, I thought, on Twitter of someone talking about, like, one of the interesting ways they play the Ulysses Klaue character that is played by Andy Serkis is that the way that he very sort of, like, in some ways subtly, in some ways more obviously, is appropriating black culture on top of everything else. Of, like, particularly have that scene where he's walking down with his crew and then, like, Fucking Martin Freeman has that great line about like, oh, didn't realize you're gonna bring your band members too. It's like, do you have like the new albums coming out? It's like, actually, yeah, it's gonna be. You want me to give you the link on Spotify and all that stuff? And he's sort of like appropriating that kind of like rap mogul, you know, like Tupac kind of like aesthetic.
One of the best laughs is at the end of the casino sequence. He blows up the safe and he's like, "I made it rain."
Exactly,
that sort of thing.
It's that kind of stuff, and it's like a smart, subtle way to sort of like paint this guy who is like supposed to represent like the worst excesses of cultural like imperialism and colonialism, and his, you know, like his whole story of going in, being like the one guy who managed to get in, like discover Wakanda, steal some vibranium and leave, and then he got a little bit of perspective of like the positive elements of being black, like in the metaphor, and then now like he can't let go of that and like wants to have that identity for himself, even though he doesn't want to have to claim any of like the negative elements of having to have that identity. You know, he is that like sort of cultural appropriation and imperialism made manifest, and I think he does a really good job at being a fucking asshole that you hate, but also is kind of funny at the same time.
And it's also just Andy Serkis is really good at this sort of thing. And because like none of the weight of the movie is really on him, he can just be off to the side having fun.
Yeah.
And weirdly, that is kind of a rare thing for Andy Serkis. He often plays very, very pivotal characters.
Yeah.
If you think of like Gollum or Caesar or King Kong or something. And it's just, it's fun. I wish he got to do this kind of thing more.
He also is very good at selling shooting a giant beam out of his hands. Like, there's just some actors are better at that than others. We've been talking a little bit about in our Star Wars ones with Christopher Lee and in Star Wars, and he can fucking sell shooting lightning out of his hands because he's a pro. Andy Serkis also very good at pretending to shoot lasers at people.
It would be weird if the King of Mocap was not good at that.
Exactly. He's brought all of his experience to bear on something very silly.
He probably mocapped the arm. I bet they like put all the dots on his fucking like missing arm.
They just put all the dots on him anyways and had to go and CG them out because like I just need to get in character and I can't if I'm not covered in dots. It's like, you don't understand, I've spent half my life with these things on.
What do you think Andy Serkis does with the hours on set for this kind of thing where he doesn't have to get the dots applied?
Right, yeah, it's like, oh my god, I'm on a movie set, and it's like, and I don't have to wake up at 4 in the morning to go into makeup.
Anyway, he's great, and also it sets up, I love his first scene with Killmonger in the museum, the whole thing where he lets the guy run, shoots him, and then is like, oh, it makes us look like amateurs. He's set up as a scumbag very effectively. But it's also when he is dispatched from the film, it's a very good moment of being like, right, this was a big red herring. Killmonger is the bad guy here. And when he asserts himself as the antagonistic force by killing the Andy Serkis character, it does a very good job of solidifying that and being like, okay, the Andy Serkis character was a goofball, like an evil, sleazy goofball. This guy's the actual, like, focus of this.
Yeah, like, Andy Serkis was a sort of he played an anarchist sort of villain. And then, but Killmonger has a purpose.
Yep. At Martin Freeman. We love Mr. Martin Freeman.
He's so good.
He can do no wrong. And yes, if you need the token white guy in your movie to react to how cool the things are around him, but not in, like, the most gawking way.
Yeah.
You get Martin Freeman.
Yes, he's just so lovable, and I'm just glad that he's like gets to be in Marvel movies, because it's like one of those of whenever they cast an actor I really like in a Marvel movie, it's like I'm desperately just like, keep them around. Like, I want them, you know, it's like one of those things, if they're going to be the main villain, like, I think as tragic as it is that we will not get more of the Killmonger character in more movies, like, it's the right storytelling choice to kill that character at the end of the movie.
Right.
It's like, I'm glad that Martin Freeman just, like, wasn't just sort of, you didn't spend your Martin Freeman card for a small supporting role in Civil War and then don't get to use him anymore. Like, keep him around as this weird token white character that does feel like this sort of, like, the proof is in the pudding kind of argument about representation in movies and, like, tokenism in movies, that it's like, it's like you never fucking see a token white character in anything. And it's like you get to see from like what that is like, and like, or you get like some like perspective on what it would be like to be black. And every fucking movie you watch has the one black character in it that is the same role in the plot that the Martin Freeman character gets. That is like, he's kind of helpful, he's a little bit funny, and it's like, but he doesn't get to contribute anything that significant, and he gets like a little bit of a cool thing to do at the end of the movie, but that's as far as it goes.
Even then, Black Panther's a good enough movie, though. It's a better written and performed and, like, executed version of that than the token black character usually is.
But, like, I guess, like, my point is that, like, a lot of the problem with tokenism usually isn't, like, the specific use of it in an individual movie. It's, like, the trend of
it happening. Sure, yeah.
And it's, like, seeing it happen in one movie, like, I think helps you project. And it's, like, if every fucking movie had, like, that, like, Martin Freeman was in every movie playing this exact same character, it would drive you fucking crazy.
Yes.
And it's, like, it is one of those things, if I already understand that, but it is one of those things that is a nice thing to be able to reference to, is, like, see, like, weird white people that, like, don't have any empathy, like, see, like, this is what it's like, project, motherfuckers, like, it's right there for you on the screen.
Yes. I am trying to... Okay, this was a tweet by a guy named Daniel Kibblesmith that I fucking loved and retweeted today. I felt extremely represented in Black Panther by the middle-aged white character who was excited to help out in small ways when appropriate.
Yeah.
That is such a perfect explanation of that character, and I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. Yep.
Martin Freeman. Put him in everything. I love him.
Put him in movies. All right. You know who else you should put in every fucking movie?
Yeah.
Mr. Michael B. Jordan.
Uh-huh.
I feel so vindicated by the love that everyone is showing for Michael B. Jordan right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I think I was a hipster on this guy in that I first saw him in The Wire, which I think was his first screen role as Wallace in the first season of The Wire. And then I saw him in Friday Night Lights as Vince, and he's so good in those. And then Fruitvale Station. And I feel like this guy is a special talent. And he has just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And now he's in this movie, and he's, like, the name that every single person is coming out of Black Panther talking about. And just a force of nature in this movie. He is unbelievable.
I love that he is the second actor to, like, Phoenix-like rise from the ashes of the Human Torch character in a Fantastic Four movie, and then be really good in another Marvel movie.
I forgot he was in that movie! I totally forgot he was in Fantastic Four.
Like, I have want on, like, a special feature on the DVD of this movie of him and Chris Evans sitting down talking about playing the Human Torch. Like, yes. I just want to see that, you know? Because it's such a weird thing of that sort of coming around. But yeah, no, he is unbelievable in this movie. And the role that is written for him and the, like structurally in the plot, what they do of this sort of... Of something of, there's so many elements here of that character that help make it to be the sort of, I think, phenomena that it is that one, you know, the old adage is, the old wisdom is 100% correct of, like, the best villain is a villain that you may disagree with their methods, but you understand why they're doing it, and you maybe, and in this case, probably do agree with their, like, reasoning behind what they want to do, and in some ways agree with the sentiment of what they're trying to enact. Like, that makes him a compelling villain because you 100% understand why he's doing what he's doing. And they get, like, kind of agree this, like, maybe it's not the worst plan in the world. Like, it's not what I would do, but you know what? Like, yeah, sure. Okay. Like, okay. But then the other thing that's really fascinating about it is that he, structurally in the plot, instead of being what is, like, the typical supervillain role in, like, a superhero movie, which is the villain role is to be this wall that the hero has to overcome, and the hero, like, tries to climb the wall the first time and fails and falls down because of some flaw that they have, and then has to overcome that flaw, and then they can overcome the wall. That's, like, usually kind of, like, the structural role that a villain plays in a superhero movie.
Like Thor Ragnarok, that's Hela.
Exactly. Like it's that's Hela, that's, like a villain in any Spider-Man movie. Like, it's almost always what that is. It's, like, you know, they're kind of defeated by the villain, or half-defeated, like, the end of the first act, that kind of stuff. In this movie, the Killmonger character instead serves as this, like, mirror reflection of the Black Panther, like, down to him literally becoming king and getting another Black Panther suit that has yellow outline instead of purple outline and all that stuff. He is this other vision of that character that, like, grew up in America instead of growing up in Wakanda in Africa and seeing things from that perspective. And the only way that T'Challa can improve and sort of fulfill his hero and protagonist role is to sort of incorporate the lived wisdom of the villain character and use that to push forward for something better. So it's this sort of, like, synthesis plot. It's not that the hero is sort of, like, the villain is just evil and the hero is good but has some sort of critical flaw that they must overcome to become even better. Instead, it's like, you know, the hero is flawed and flawed in critical ways in their perspective at the beginning of the movie. And then the villain has, like, a really powerful perspective, but is sort of twisted by hatred and that kind of stuff. And the only way to succeed is for them to sort of synthesize by the end of the movie. And then that is what happens. And that's such a compelling, interesting plot structure that's not necessarily unique, but is incredibly rare for superhero movies. And I can't think of a superhero movie off the top of my head that does that.
Well, I can think of a lot that give... I don't know if I could name necessarily every one of them, but I definitely, the thought of, like, the superhero villain having a good point is a pretty frequent one.
Sure.
But it's the follow-through. It's, like, actually letting that point stand once the villain is defeated and the hero having to reckon with that point. That, to me, is what makes Killmonger and Michael B. Jordan's performance so good. Because I think it walks that line of, like, is he right or is he wrong? Super deftly. Because when he says, you know, that, like, one that, like, people, black people all around the world are abused, he's 100% right.
Yeah.
When he says, like, you guys have the power to stop this, he's 100% right. And when he, the way he connects that dot of, like, we're just gonna blow these motherfuckers away, I guess, you could say maybe that's not the best way to do it, but you also, I don't think in any way can blame him for that on some level.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if you grew up in his scenario, abandoned by your home country, living in a country that is virulently racist in so many ways.
And not just abandoned by your home country, but your home country came to your house and killed your father.
Yes, and you were not ever able to reconcile that. And you knew Wakanda was like this mythical thing in your head, this salvation point. Prepare your whole life to get there. Get there. It's, yeah, he would probably use that power that way, and I don't think in any part of his argument he is 100% wrong. There are very real wrongs that he is trying to right in this film, and again, this movie doesn't sand the edges off that. Like, T'Challa doesn't come in during that conversation and be like, not all white people, dude! Like, I got Martin Freeman right here! He's great!
Look, it's Martin Freeman! Like, not everybody is slimy Andy Serkis!
You don't want to kill Martin Freeman!
Look at that smile!
Yeah.
He's so unassuming but adorable.
And we joke... But a different version of this movie would totally have done that, you know? And this doesn't do that at all. And so there is a lot of conflict, you feel, going into the last act of this movie in that, like, you kind of want Killmonger's mission... Like, you want the ends Killmonger wants, maybe, but not the means in a lot of ways.
But, and like, even, the other thing about the plan and all that stuff, though, is that, thinking about it, that... Framed from a different perspective, if, like, white people were aliens or demons or something that's, like, you could paint them metaphorically as non-human, you could totally sell that plan. And that would be... He would be the protagonist of the movie.
Yes.
And like, that would be the end of the movie, would be that plan succeeding and overthrowing the alien invaders and then, like celebrate and it's, like, you know, you all dance on the forest moon of Endor and it's, like, great. Fantastic. Right? Like, from a different perspective, you could 100% sell that mass carnage and nobody would blink an eye.
Yep. And I also think the way it frames it in a colonial history and context is super interesting. There's a line he has that is kind of in the middle of almost a montage sequence after he's killed or thinks he's killed T'Challa, where he's, like, looking at the weapons and he says, the sun is never going to set on the Wakandan Empire.
Yeah.
And that's one of those lines that just your mouth kind of drops of, like, they got that into a Disney movie.
Yeah.
You know, because that is a really subversive idea to put out there. But that's the thing it's playing with, in that he's saying, you know what? Throughout hundreds, thousands of years of human history, we've been fucked by these colonial forces. We've had the power all this time in this, you know, fantasy world. I'm going to do the same thing. And you kind of are like, I, as a white guy sitting in the theater, this hypothetical scenario would mean my own death or subjugation, I guess. But I can't say he's wrong.
Yeah, no, yeah.
You know? And that's the smart thing about that character. And of course, then Michael B. Jordan just plays that so well. There is, you know, one of the things that unites all of his performances is just the sheer confidence he brings to bear on what he does. But I also think, and this is true certainly of the work he does with Ryan Coogler, the way that confidence masks other things, like this other vulnerabilities and pain he has inside him. And that's a thing that, you know, Oscar Grant has in Fruitvale Station, in terms of he's, you know, kind of hustling, you would say, to try to, you know, get his life back together, because that character is someone who had been in jail, and he has I don't know if it's his wife or girlfriend, but he has a girlfriend and a child, and he wants to get his job back, and these are a lot of the things he's dealing with in that movie, and the confidence is something that he's using to kind of try to get through the day, because he has a lot of on his plate. In Creed, it's this guy who is very skilled, has a lot of confidence as a boxer and as a guy, but that is belying this deep-seated vulnerability of, like, can I be as good as the father I never knew, and things like that. And then you get to this movie, and it's even more, and we don't get to know Killmonger as well as those other movies, because he's not the main character, but what that's hiding in terms of just anger is so interesting, and I think that as a force, what he represents in this movie is so interesting, that anger and the righteous anger he has, and how curdled that has become, without ever, and the performance and the writing and the direction, letting it show that that anger has curdled in a destructive way without dismissing the source, root, or true feelings and experiences of that anger. All of those are really complicated, interesting things that he plays.
Yeah. And for me, I think the most interesting thing about the character is that, like, he is the character that is, like, from their, like, origin in POV in some ways, most similar to the people who made the movie. Like Ryan Coogler did not grow up in Africa. He grew up in the 90s in Oakland.
Right.
Like the fucking Killmonger character. Like, that's the... And normally, that's the perspective you would have would be from, you know, like, Peter Parker was raised in Ireland or something, you know? Like, Peter Parker was raised in New York, which is where Stan Lee lived. It's like, Captain America lived in New York. Fucking Iron Man. Guess where he lived? Fucking New York. Like... All of those, like, the vast, vast majority of superhero characters all are, like, from the perspective of the people that made them. And Black Panther was, like, even if Black Panther had been black in America, it still would not have been from the perspective of the people that originally made him. But, like, they, you know, made the character sort of an anti-hero and set him, like, living in this fictional African, future African city, whatever, of Wakanda. And it's interesting that, like, when you come around to then black creators getting to work with that character, that, like, that's typically African-Americans. That is, like, people who have some connection to that culture but were raised in America. And that relationship that Killmonger has of having this fantasy, like, sort of fairy tale land almost of, like, Wakanda, this like African paradise where imperialism and colonialism never hit it, and I am he's the fucking like heir to the throne. He's the like Prince Eric basically to this fairy tale magic African nation, and you know that, and he lost his father when he's young. There's so much in the like black narrative of America that you can see in that character nestled in there, and particularly the two scenes in this movie that really hit me incredibly hard was the sort of Paris scenes near like sort of the second half of the movie where they go back to the ancestral plane, where you get it from Killmonger's perspective, and then Black Panther has to go back, and Killmonger having like going in like his version of like the plains of Africa is this the small apartment he lived in Oakland, mm-hmm. where he found his dead dad, and you know, and discovered like the notes or whatever that were there that helped him learn the Wakandan language and gave him the ring and all that stuff. And he gets that conversation with his dad where you get some of that sense of, like, another one of the things is, like, you never see his mom. Like, you never, like, the only female presence in his life that you see is this weird girlfriend character that he just kills, like, near the beginning of the movie. Because, like, that, like, lack of a feminine presence is also clearly there. And, like, there's a lot of that kind of toxic masculinity, like, not knowing how to cry, not knowing how to deal with these emotions and these aggressions, like... is so nestled in that character, and it's that scene where you get that insight into his mind, and because he's in his mind, like the kind of the guard drops a little bit and he's with the spirit of his father. Like, I found that so powerful.
The father, played by Sterling K. Brown, who is just a wonderful actor, who is currently on, I think, a never-ending awards tour of winning every TV award on the planet for the show This Is Us, which I have not seen, but I did see The People versus O.J. Simpson, where he is amazing as I think he's one of the prosecuting attorneys on that show. But anyway, yeah. Just great. Pretty much, throw a dart at an actor in this movie and they are an awesome, great actor.
Yeah.
But yes.
You know, also Forrest Whitaker's in this.
Oh, right. Forrest Whitaker's really good. He's really good, yep. Forrest Whitaker doing his big, hammy thing oriented in exactly the right direction.
Exactly.
Yes.
The right use of Forrest Whitaker.
As opposed to the one I'm thinking of is Rogue One, where that was the thoroughly wrong use of Forrest Whitaker. Yeah. But yes, no, he's so good here. Yeah, no, I love everything you said about that. I don't have anything to more. Yeah, those ancestral plane sequences are amazing. And specifically connecting it to the Oakland apartment is it's just an incredibly powerful scene.
And also just recoloring that like prologue scene where you have like, because at the end of that prologue scene, the last shot you're left with is the little kid on the basketball court looking up and seeing through the clouds like, oh, there's a UFO there, or like something magical up there. And then you revisit that and you realize, oh shit, that's Killmonger and what's up in that. And like that plane flying away is carrying the dude that just killed his dad.
And of course, the symbology connecting that to the end of the film. I mean, this is a symbol of just how well, I think, written and thought out this movie is, to a much greater degree than, like, these kinds of movies, Marvel movies, superhero movies, Hollywood blockbusters usually are, is starting with that image of the kid who we will learn is the villain of the piece, looking up in wonderment that we learn is a very dark wonderment, to the end of the film of another black kid looking up, and that image of a black child looking up being redeemed by the choices T'Challa makes at the end. I mean, these are the kinds of things that just the follow-through of the script again, because that's the thing that's missing in a lot of superhero movies. And it's actually something I think Marvel has gotten better at in, like, the last year specifically. And, like, Thor Ragnarok has the follow-through at the end of, like, nope, we're gonna blow the whole fucking thing up. And Guardians of the Galaxy 2 at the end has the follow-through of, we're actually gonna kill this father character, and we're gonna leave him dead, and we're gonna end with Rocket Raccoon crying. You know, like, those sorts of things are the kinds of things that I think Marvel and Hollywood at large kind of likes to run away from at the end in favor of resetting a status quo. Kind of like the end of Iron Man 3 or something, where he blows up all the suits, but then nothing comes of it.
Exactly,
you know? Like, but that's not what you get here. You get a real follow-through. Have you seen Creed yet?
No, now I need to get around with it. I know that Fruitvale Station is on Netflix. So
okay.
I'll be watching that soon.
As good as Michael B. Jordan is here, even better in Creed than Fruitvale Station. I mean, those are more his movies,
exactly,
obviously. Yeah. But, like, Creed was, like, really acclaimed when it came out, and it did decent box office. It is still kind of one of the most criminally underrated movies of the decade, because that's, like, that movie should just be a household fucking name. It is so amazingly good.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to my Michael B. Jordan tour of watching Fruitvale Station, Creed, and Fantastic Four.
I was looking up his IMDb. He was also in the movie Chronicle. I totally forgot that.
All right.
That movie is okay at best. I do remember him being very good in that movie. So, there you go. He is typically the most memorable part of anything he's in.
If I ever end up watching Fantastic Four, I will inform you if that's the case.
Don't know how that wouldn't be the case in that specific movie. Like,
well, I think there might be other elements of that movie that are memorable, but just not in the right way.
Yeah. Anyway, yes. I mean, the movie's only 88 minutes or something, so how much can they even fit in? Mm. All right. Where else do you want to go with this? I mean, you want to talk about kind of where they go with this at the end of the film?
Yeah, let's talk about the finale. So, like, going back to the, because I talked about the Oakland ancestral scene is awesome, but then also I love when, you know, after T'Challa is defeated and dethroned and has his, like, you know, sort of Simba moment or whatever, he has to come back as Hamlet.
I have to admit, I did see a lot of Lion King parallels here, and I thought, you know, Jon Favreau is making that Lion King remake, and I'm just like, boy, Disney really should have. I mean, I don't think that movie needs to be made, and I wouldn't want to waste Ryan Coogler's time with it, but he would make a more interesting Lion King movie, probably.
But that scene where T'Challa goes back to the ancestral plane and is greeted with his father and these other people who you assume are the previous Black Panthers, and his dad's like, come on, it's like time for you to join us, and T'Challa just says, like, no, and then eventually, like, just says repeatedly, you were wrong, and, like, that scene is so, like, just, like, really emotional gut punch that is such a, because the movie just does so much, like, big and small work to work up to that character moment where, especially when you think, when you bring it back to where he was in Civil War, of where, like, the whole thing with his character was this revenge mission to, like, avenge his father because of how much he cared about his father, and his father was so, like, this compelling, compassionate character that the little bit you saw of him in Civil War, they did a lot in that movie to, like, win you over to that guy immediately. And then the little bit you see of him in this movie also, like, before you find out what actually happened in the apartment, like it's like T'Chaka seems like that was, like, a hell of a legacy to live up to. And then have him having to realize, dude, you're probably you're probably a better person than your dad was. Like, your dad was a good guy, but he made some big mistakes, and you need to learn from those mistakes.
Well, and it's you know, legacy is obviously a theme that runs throughout this film. It's in all of Ryan Coogler's movies so far. But one of the ways it's played with here of T'Challa, you know, not like falling out of love with his father, not coming to the decision that his father was a bad man, but having to realize he was human and that he can learn from those mistakes. And being the king doesn't just mean idolizing and maintaining the past. That is a really interesting, compelling thing, because who hasn't had to deal with some of those things in their life, whether their parents are alive or dead? But those moments when you recognize people you look up to aren't perfect, it's just one of the many very human touches that also has a million different, you know, cultural thematic signifiers going on.
Yeah. But then that also allows the lead up to a fucking just awesome moment when Killmonger is like rallying everybody and sending off the first plane to go deliver the super weapons, and it just blows up and crashes, and then T'Challa in Black Panther gear steps up on top of his like fucking yes. Like, this movie just, like, it has all like the soulful, beautiful thematic stuff, and then it just has one that's like, that's fucking cool. That's really fucking cool. That costume looks awesome.
That's something we haven't said. Like, this movie has so many amazing costumes, it's actually easy for the superhero costume to kind of get buried in the mix. That is one of the best superhero costumes ever.
Yeah.
The one in Civil War was great, but it's even better here once, you know, Shuri got her hands on it and got to make it all purple and shit. That was awesome. But yeah. I also love that just, like, they set up that thing of, like, she has the gold version and the purple version. T'Challa's like, you know, no, that's, you know, it's just too, like, stylish for me or whatever.
Like, the point is to not be noticed.
Right, the point is to not be noticed. So he's like, I'm going to take the different one. And Killmonger's like, oh, yeah, I totally want that.
Yeah.
Yes, it's very, very telling. I also like that Michael B. Jordan, once he comes to Wakanda, I don't think his shirt is on again for the rest of the movie.
It's true, yeah.
Unless he's in, like, the Black Panther costume. I have seen a lot of people appreciating that online.
Yes, no, anyway. He's attractive man.
Yes, and that must have been a lot of makeup for all the, like, scars he has. Because it's also, like, it's not a thing they hide, because when he's, you know, he's got his shirt off for the movie, that's a substantial amount of the movie where they had to do all of that every day.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But that's a great, like, scene, though, when he takes off that shirt. Because it's another instance of just, like, really smart filmmaking of setting it up a little bit with him showing, like, a little bit of his arm to the Andy Serkis character, and, like, to set up, like, oh, like, each of these scars is a kill. And then when you get to that confrontation scene, he takes off his full shirt and you realize this guy's killed, like, 100 people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
It makes his name feel less silly and more threatening than the Killmonger, you know? It's a fine line with comic book movies and that stuff.
Well, they also, I think they specifically here make it a moniker he got in the army, not his actual family name, which would be a little on the nose.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Gary Killmonger. It's like of the Pennsylvania Killmongers. It's like, yeah.
All right. Yeah, so that whole last battle scene, we get all the characters together. Everyone has something cool to do. It's a great big, like, kind of, you know, war sort of scene, like almost like a Lord of the Rings kind of confrontation or something.
The battle rhinos come into play. Oh, that's very cool.
The battle rhinos are fucking great. And I love specifically, I think it's one of them is running down T'Challa, and then is that when Okoye comes in?
Yeah, and it screeches to a halt and just licks her face.
Yep, yeah,
this is a great shot.
No, the battle rhinos are awesome, and if there's any justice in the world, they will also be in Infinity War, because it looks like we've got some big battle scenes there.
Yeah.
And I think the Avengers could totally use the battle rhinos.
Exactly, yes. I want to see Captain America riding a battle rhino. That's something I want.
Here's what I want. I want Rocket Raccoon and Groot on the back of a rhino riding into battle against Thanos' forces.
What I want is bearded Captain America riding on the back of a battle rhino against Thanos, and on his left shoulder is Baby Groot, and on his right shoulder is Rocket Raccoon, and they're both firing guns at Thanos. That's what I want.
That would be pretty great.
Yes.
Also, I also love that is not anywhere near out of the realm of possibility for Marvel. Yeah. That could totally happen.
If James Gunn was making that movie, that 100% that scene would be in there. Yes. I can confirm it.
Yes. Anyway, all right. So many good things happen here. We also have, of course, the final confrontation between Black Panther and Killmonger down in the trains, which is a whole cool thing going on there. And then, back to the line I referenced earlier about him talking about the legacy of slaves who chose to die on the ships rather than go live in bondage. And again, like, that's a great moment. What makes the movie solidify and work for me in the end is the scenes that follow it, in that it's not just, all right, Killmonger had a point, but he's dead now, so we don't have to worry about it, which is the way a lot of movies would reset the status quo. It's that T'Challa comes out of that and says, you know what? We're going to make the world a better place, and we're going to do it in the best way we know how, and we're going to take these, you know, first steps into a bolder, larger world. And doing it in a couple of those contexts. There's the mid-credits scene with the UN. But I just think particularly the note it does of going back to the Oakland, like, projects and looking at the apartment building and T'Challa telling... And having Shuri there in that scene is so important. And looking at all these buildings saying, I bought that one and that one and that one. And, you know, we're going to create a Wakandan community center. And we're going to do all this outreach for technology. And you're going to get to, like, lead this one. And
that's how she meets Ned.
Yes.
Said they go on a field trip to Oakland and then there.
Yes.
That's make that movie.
That could be the beginning of Infinity War.
Exactly. Anyway. Yes. It's
and as that world. Right as they meet, that's when Thanos' ship like comes barreling into New York or something. I don't know. But anyway, you have all that. And then the ship coming in and of course, him giving this wonder to all these, you know, black children and making this commitment to help share this culture and this legacy with them and that pride.
Yeah.
And the last thing being, who are you? And him just smiling, cut to credits. Perfect.
Yeah.
And somehow the mid-credits scene doesn't ruin it, which normally it would, because normally you want to let a moment like that hang, you know? But I think the UN scene is so perfect because you get that jackass white guy from whatever country he's in of like, what can a bunch of farmers offer the world? And T'Challa just grins.
Yeah, and he gives that little smile, and that's one of those things of where, you know, you realize like how perfect getting Chadwick Boseman to play this character was, because like that little smile holds so much of that, like the humanity of that character. And that's like you like see like the version of that character that was joking around with his little sister with his like fucking sandals, you know, like you see that in his eyes.
And how comfortable he feels in that role, whether it's in Oakland or at the UN, of him being like, I think you can tell this feels right, of like breaking Wakanda out of this isolationist viewpoint.
Yeah,
and it feels right because it's the right thing to do because it feels right, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I did wonder when that scene was going on, and T'Challa starts to smile. I wondered if we were going to get a really crazy version of like the end of Iron Man where he says, "I am Iron Man," where instead of him saying, "I am Black Panther," he would just smile and then transform into the Black Panther at the UN.
Well, if he would smile, transform into the Black Panther, and then like the roof would fly off, and there'd be like 100 spaceships flying around. It's like, you guys have no fucking idea. We're on some whack shit in Africa right now.
Yes, but like that would be totally counterproductive to his actual mission.
Yeah, but it would be pretty cool.
It'd be a
big mic drop moment.
Yes. So, I mean, what else do you have to say about these scenes and how the movie kind of wraps it up together?
Yeah, like that, like when, you know, he defeats Killmonger and then like carries him like up the elevator to watch the Wakandan sunset, because that was like his father told him that, you know, that the Wakandan sunset is more beautiful than anything. And that's like another section where the movie feels so fucking anime to me. That's like, and I kind of like that synthesis plot structure is kind of anime in a lot of ways as well. Like that, like push, like ideological push and pull and meeting in the middle. But then also just this like, oh, we were sworn enemies and I've defeated you. And now like, you're going to die cradled in my arms over sunset. That is literally what happens to Master Asia in G Gundam. That's like it is that exact fucking scene. And G Gundam is a silly anime, but that scene is powerful. But it's like, there's just something about that relationship that is like looking at it. It was kind of like, you know, I think you talking about watching Guardians 2 and watching the funeral scene and being like, I can't believe this is in a fucking Marvel movie. Like, I'm like kind of tearing up a little bit. This is like, holy shit. Like, this is like, you don't normally get that in a superhero movie. You don't get that kind of scene and that kind of resolution with the villain.
Well, and the line I was mentioning there about the legacy of slavery, he gets to be right until his death. Like, they don't take away what was, you know, true about what he was fighting for. Like,
yeah, and in some ways it feels like he has resolved his character arc of, I think, kind of understanding where he, like, he kind of, like, I think, lets go at the end of that kind of, like, Wakandan fantasy and embraces himself as, like, motherfucker, like, I am descended from these people that were taken from this, like, were taken from this country, and you know, like, I am that, like, I am American, like, I am African-American, like, kind of re-embraces that identity in some ways, like, that, like, there's so much packed into that line of, like, finding power in where he comes from, and that is different from where T'Challa comes from.
Yeah.
And like recognizing those differences.
Absolutely.
And embracing it in some way.
You know, it is, it's something I'm thinking about, that like prestige Hollywood movies that deal with race are almost always about slavery. Like literally, like they wind up being historical accounts. Some by, well, most by white directors, because that's how Hollywood rolls historically. Some by black directors, like, you know, like 12 Years a Slave or The Birth of a Nation, or The New Birth of a Nation, not the old one. Because that's kind of the box in which there's a historical distance to that that makes people feel more comfortable having the conversations. And those are important stories to tell. Obviously, you have to tell and remember those stories. But I think it is, in some ways, so much more powerful to see these ideas played with in a very contemporary way on a big popcorn, you know, Hollywood superhero canvas for a mainstream audience, and still not sugarcoating some of these ideas. You know, it doesn't, like, solve race relations. It's in a fantasy setting. But, you know, this is part of breaking down those barriers of being able to talk about race on film, and especially on mainstream blockbuster film, is not hiding it behind some of those layers. And, of course, there's layers of fantasy here, obviously. But when it deals with it, it's not a complete product of the fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Because I feel like the way that racism is dealt with in popular media is one of two ways. It is both of those ways are means of acquiring distance. It's either the historical distance of setting it in, you know, like when slavery was legal and open in America, or it's by crafting some sort of like fantasy metaphor about elves or orcs or dwarves or something.
And then having white people play them.
Yeah, or aliens, you know, like District 11 or whatever. Like it's that kind of stuff. Like it's that, or like Dragon Age in terms of video games. Like video games that do this all the fucking time. And it's like that's one of the ways you acquire that distance. And there's always, or like, you know, the X-Men movies and having to use mutants to do that. And there's always something like really weird about it, because it's like, it's not a particularly great metaphor in some ways. Like, you can kind of get at some of those issues, but particularly like X-Men, it's like, you know, I've never met a gay person that could like commit genocide with their mind. Like, that's not, so it's like not exactly like, you know, that's not the perfect metaphor. It's like there are some legitimate arguments about being concerned about people being born with the ability to like control all metal, even the iron in your blood that could just kill you with a thought, you know?
Like, yes, like realistically, that would be a much harder societal issue to like, or actually it would be much simpler in some ways of like, yes, for the greater good, we probably do want to chastise the person with the metal powers, you know?
It's like a lot of times those metaphors, it is something that like it's, kind of like of what I was saying with tokenism. It's like, it's fine if it's just one movie, it's just one book, it's just one thing, like every once in a while it happens. It's the same thing with like the Bechdel test or something like that. It's like, if it just happens in one instance, who gives a shit? Like, that doesn't say anything about an individual movie. What happens is when you have this trend that's like, every single time we have this conversation, it has to be couched in either historical story or through metaphor, and that just means that you're like, you know, I'm all for, like, the power of metaphor and symbolism in art, but, like, that's, sometimes those problems need to be tackled directly, not couched through those things, especially when it's so present, and it's, like, this present social issue. It's not necessarily, like, this big, like, universal theme about love and humanity. It's, like, no, this is about, like, current-day racism and, like politics. You, like, couching it in metaphor only gets you so far. Mm-hmm. And, again, it's, like, it's fine for, like, a couple of things that do it when they do it really well, but for that to be the, like, mode of like the preferred method of dealing through those issues in popular fiction, I think it's an issue.
It absolutely is. And I do think this movie shows us a language for how to do that in this kind of movie.
Yeah, that you can have it be a fantasy movie and have it still be like black people and white people. It doesn't have to be white people and elves that are also white, but are stand-in for black people, you know?
I mean, the other thing I always have a problem with in those fantasy things is like, black people are also human. They're not elves.
Exactly.
Like skin color does not make you like biologically different in that way.
Yeah, we're all like, the human. Metaphors are, they, when you dig into the metaphor too deep, it like gets really rough. It's like sometimes it's just better to be like, you don't need to do that. Like you can have it be a cool, big, crazy, fantastical movie and still deal with race with like actual, like representing actual people and actual issues, not couched behind a symbol.
Exactly. All right, anything else to say about the film itself, the larger structure of the movie, before we move on to maybe some wrap-up kind of questions, topics on this?
No, I think I said my say. It's really cool, and she throws a spear through the car, and it stops the car.
Oh, other thing I want to mention, The music by Ludwig Göransson.
Oh, yeah.
Such a good score. I think easily the best score for a Marvel movie. Ludwig Göransson is awesome. He, I first noticed him. He was the composer for Community, the TV show. Met Donald Glover there. And when Donald Glover started his rap career as Childish Gambino, I believe Göransson has done all the production for his albums, which are amazing pieces of production. So he's really good with that stuff. I know he's done the scores for all of Coogler's movies. And I was saying this to you before the podcast when we were picking out our theme song this week. One of the things I love about Black Panther is it doesn't just pay lip service to using some, like, African instruments in the score. It's not just, like, a standard Hollywood score that has some drums.
Right.
It's, like, they really, like, commit to it. They have the instruments in there. They build the songs around those instruments or those voices. And it just sounds different in the way the movie looks different. It has specificity, and that matters.
Yes, and then I think I was also telling you before we recorded the podcast and talking about the music, that I love any movie that so thoroughly commits to an ominous music sting for its villain, like this movie does, like, you know, like Imperial March for Darth Vader, for this movie, like, fucking every time it cuts back to Killmonger from another scene, it, like, it cuts straight to him and just goes, ba-da-da-da-da-da, and then it, like, and then if it goes into the full version, it, like, sort of, like, transitions, like, a lead into, a, like, a hip-hop beat,
yes.
But fucking, I love that shit. It's so good. It gives the village so much cinematic presence when they have this, like, music sting associated with them.
Absolutely. All right. The Bucky Barnes scene at the end.
I just read about it. Like, I'm okay. Not, like, I can only tolerate one post-credits scene. It's okay. Like, it's my limit. Like, I can't do two. It's too much these days.
I understand. It's much more substantial than, like, a lot of the post-credits scenes are these days for Marvel. It's like a good minute long. And it's a nice little moment. It's Shuri is like has been working with Bucky, and that's it seems like they're friends now, and that's nice. The issue is that it is so much just a teaser for a different movie. It has nothing really to do with this movie we just saw.
Does it feel like one of those where it's like it was just footage pulled from Infinity War or something like that almost?
No, because it very much looks like this movie. But, like, it could be in Infinity War somewhere, I guess. It just, it very much looks like, the way they, like, do the skybox of Wakanda and stuff. It's just, it feels like that. But, yeah, it just, like, I actually, James Mangold, the director of Logan.
Right, yeah.
Was tweeting about his issues with post-credit scenes. And actually, I got into a brief Twitter argument with James Mangold, which was weird, because I wasn't arguing with him. But yeah. I think he thought I was. But he was saying, like, it sucks when they're, like, just selling you another movie in the credits of one movie, and that's the thing that bothers him, which I totally get, and I was agreeing with that point. I said, you know, I think the little jokes and stuff don't hurt, but I do, and what I was also trying to convey here was that what does bother me is when they rob gravity from the movie that happened. Like, I think all five of the scenes at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy 2 are fun little teases, but also, I do think the movie might be stronger if it just ended with Rocket crying and you went to black.
Right.
Like, I don't know if it would be as true to its own crazy self, but, like, you kind of want to let those moments hang. I think the UN scene in the middle of these credits does a great job of letting that earlier moment hang and creating another moment that hangs.
Yeah.
I do think the Bucky Barnes things feels a little bit like, and now, a teaser for Infinity War. And it's just, those things have definitely gotten to annoy me.
Yeah, I think, like, what I would almost prefer, if they're going to do this fucking post-credits scene thing and, like, are very intent on, like, teasing the next movie, is something of, like, because I do not like that there are now two post-credits scenes. I think that's, like, excessive and bizarre and weird, and dread the day when we have three post-credits scenes as the norm in every movie. But I like the, like, more designed bit of, like, the credits that then leads into, like, the, like, sort of a more, like, fleshed out post-credits scene that feels like a coda.
Those can be fun, yeah.
Yeah, like, that, like, I think is, like, because it feels like it's more, like, in the presentation and everything, it feels like it's, like, more organically a piece of the film. As opposed to the, like, sitting through 15 minutes of a black screen with white text and then getting a little, like, 30 seconds at the end just feels so weird and ethereal and, like, don't really understand why it's attached to it. But if they are insistent on doing that, I would almost just rather it be just, like, a next time from Marvel Studios, like, Captain America, and, like, just do it like a fucking, like, next time preview at the end of a TV show episode, you know?
I think I agree with that because that's what it is. And it's, if you just framed it that way, it would feel way less gross, actually. You know? Because, not that it's super gross, I think. It's because sometimes they're nice scenes. Like, this one, like, Sebastian Stan is good in it. You know, Letitia Wright is there. That's cool. But, like, it is just like a next time thing would almost just make it feel more honest.
Yeah, and or they could do what a lot of, if we were keeping like with the anime influence we've been talking about, like a lot of anime do this weird thing with next time previews where it's like the character is like removed somehow from like the diegesis of the piece and is like talking in the abstract about like they're like, it's like the characters are kind of breaking the fourth wall and just like, hey, I'm Black Panther. Next time from Marvel Studios is like, and then Shuri interrupts and it's like, wait, what are you talking about? Am I in this movie? It's like, I don't know. Are you? It's like, let's check. I'm just like this, like totally goofy, completely break the fourth wall. I want them to go all anime with it.
All right. So I agree. That's my advice. I think that's a good pitch. Final kind of question about not just, I mean, the movie is great. We've talked about the movie. The box office, we don't have the full returns, but it did do $75 million on Friday alone. It looks like the estimates I was seeing from Box Office Mojo is this is projected for the 3-day to open higher than even Civil War did, mm-hmm. which is so fucking insane. They paid Robert Downey Jr. like $50 million and part of the back end to be in that movie hoping it would get that big.
Yeah.
Turned out all they needed was to make a Black Panther movie.
Yeah. Like, I love that we are living in a world where fucking Black Panther is going to spank Justice League at the box office. Like, this is going to be embarrassing.
Every superhero movie has spanked Justice League at the box office, but it is funny. Like, it will, by Tuesday, I think is the estimate, it will have outgrossed all of Justice League's domestic run.
Yeah.
Which is just insane. Yeah, for the 4-day, it's going to do over $200 million, set all the February records. That is just, again, like, it's too big a conversation to have right now, but I think the sea change this and Wonder Woman in particular could have for the industry if they open their fucking eyes, Hollywood executives, could be monumental. Because
in some ways, this will be the greatest test, or the greatest test that capitalism has ever faced. This is like, are you actually going to go after the money, or are you too entrenched in like cultural imperialism to follow it?
Yeah, I mean, because we've known this forever, that obviously there are lots of black people in the United States.
Yeah, there's
they like to go to the movies, too.
There is a starved audience in America of representation.
Because there are plenty of movies aimed at black people, but they typically are not, you know, they're smaller, like, comedies or dramas that are on a much smaller budget or scale, and they frequently do very well when they come out.
Like it's Get Out, which made a shit ton of money for a movie like that.
Yes, and you know, or like, as a different example, like all the Tyler Perry movies or something. Yeah. Like, you know, this is an open secret to the industry, and it took until, you know, 2018 to make a movie on this kind of scale going for that kind of money, which is weird, but whatever. I mean, it's not weird, it's racist. But
yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense in the world we live in, even though it's utterly illogical.
So I'm curious to see that. Obviously, there will be a Black Panther 2.
Yeah.
I will say, though, this movie is so good and so complete and feels like it leaves so little on the table, if it leaves anything. I'm really having trouble. What would a Black Panther 2 look like? I'm very curious what a sequel to this would be. I wonder if Ryan Coogler would want to return. Kevin Feige has already said he'd like him to return because if you had Ryan Coogler,
this movie made a lot of money. He definitely wants it to return.
Yes. Also, it was really good. Yeah. But yeah, like, I don't know if Ryan Coogler is a guy interested in sequels. That is, you know, the jury's out on that. He's only made 3 movies and none of them are sequels. He could definitely do the Chris Nolan approach of, like, make another Black Panther and write himself a blank check for the entire future of his career.
Yeah.
A la, like, Chris Nolan doing The Dark Knight Rises and, like, making the devil's deal and then, like, but I get to make whatever I want the rest of my life. Yeah, so we'll see. But I'm very curious because Infinity War obviously is on the horizon. It's been shot. It's coming out. We'll see what happens there. I'm very curious what a Black Panther 2 would be. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's just something that this movie sort of like, you know, cleans its plate so thoroughly that it can be anything. Like,
that's very true. Yeah.
It's kind of like sort of like how I feel about like a Wonder Woman 2. That it's just like, do whatever you want with it. Because it's like, you can do anything. You said what you needed to say with this first movie. Like, it's so contained that, like, I really want a Black Panther 2 because of how good this was, and I love the characters and everything. But, like, it would not be a horrible tragedy if there never was another one because this is so perfect in and of itself. Like, it can stand on its own time.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying I don't want one. I just think it's interesting to try to think about it because usually, especially with, like, Marvel movies that are this big ongoing universe, you have your little pieces of breadcrumbs left to let you think about what would the next one be. Like, Iron Man is very easy. There will be another person with evil technology who he would go fight.
Right.
But, like, this one, it could be anything, and that'll be great, and you've got such a rich ensemble. You can put the focus in other directions. It's going to be very cool.
Shuri needs to meet Ned, and I would not mind if Ned also became a supporting character in the next Black Panther movie.
Yes. I was also thinking, if Chris Evans is indeed done with Marvel after Infinity War, I think T'Challa will slide right on in into that Avengers-like leadership role.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. If you need a new, like you know, like straight arrow in the Avengers cast to replace Captain America, yeah, Black Panther's there.
It is amazing. Like, Marvel is probably on the verge of losing most of their, like, Gen 1 cast soon because, you know, I think Chris Evans wants to move on to other things. Robert Downey Jr. is in his 50s and, you know, keeps breaking his legs on the set and stuff. You know, I don't know where Chris Hemsworth's head is at, but I also don't know how many more Thor movies he has in him. And yet, it doesn't feel like a problem at all because they have done such a good job of building up kind of the B and C team, not in terms of quality, just the next generations.
Yeah.
And we still don't have Captain Marvel. That's on the horizon and stuff. Yeah. So great things yet to come. I'm very excited.
Yes, it is one of the, like the, I think you said a couple of times, the great joys of these movies is how vibrant and powerful and effective the characters are. And just like the knowledge that you'll get to see them again in new context with like interacting with different characters, bouncing off of different weird elements of the universe.
I'm so psyched for Infinity War.
Yes.
And I love that also, like, I'm excited for Infinity War for totally different reasons than I was excited for Black Panther. Black Panther is, you know, it's a more dramatic film than a lot of Marvel's movies. It's still very cool and exciting, but like it also it activates a lot of intellectual parts of the brain, you know?
Yeah.
I don't really expect that out of Infinity War. I am excited for the childlike glee of mashing action figures together.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, yes. And like, again, just thinking about other character mashups, Shuri and Rocket Raccoon is another one that would be very high on my list of holy fucking shit. Of just, like, that's kind of how I rate the characters in these movies is, like, if you can imagine putting a character in this movie in with locked in a room with a character from one of the other movies, how, like, amazing would that scene be in your head? And it's like, there's a lot of characters in this movie that I'm like, they're locked into rooms with, like, Rocket Raccoon and Thor and shit.
Well, I'm looking forward to, in July, after Ant-Man and the Wasp comes out, I will probably redo again my Marvel movie rankings list with all of the 2018 films.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for now, I think Black Panther would be a number one.
Yeah. It's almost like it's something where Black Panther feels like it so stands apart from the Marvel movies in terms of, like, what it is going for and what it achieves. That, yeah, like, I can't disagree with that at all.
Let black people and women and other minorities who don't usually get to direct films direct more films.
Yeah, like, and again, like, this isn't just a, like, sort of hearts and minds thing. It's like, you'll make money. Like, it's, I don't understand why it's not happening. I do understand why it's not happening, but it's like, you know, capitalism doesn't work the way that people think it does.
It is, going back to what we said about Star Wars with them hiring, you know, the Game of Thrones guys, in a world where you just saw Wonder Woman make a fuck ton of money, Get Out make a fuck ton of money, Black Panther's making a fuck ton of money, you have Star Wars. You have your fuck tons of money with interesting directors from points of view who don't usually get handed the keys to the kingdom.
You have Donald Glover signed on as fucking Lando Calrissian.
Yes. I don't know.
It'll make you money.
At the very least, I hope Donald Glover gets to do like a rap at the end of the Solo movie about the plot of the movie, Will Smith style. That idea probably disgusts Donald Glover, but he should totally do it just for fun.
Yes, at least like as a DVD extra.
All right. We will be back next week. Next week we will have our next Doctor Who bonus podcast as well on the sixth Doctor story, Vengeance on Varos. So that'll be fun. And we'll see what else we have to talk about.
Yes, and as a preview for that, I'll put this up on Twitter so that people know. But I just want to also put out there another other required viewing, like Vengeance on Varos. Also, you have to, because we are going to talk about this, so you need to watch it also, Jonathan.
Okay.
You have to watch the Sixth Doctor music video they made to try to bring the show back when it was temporarily canceled in the mid-80s called Doctor in Distress. It is the best worst thing ever made in the history of Doctor Who. Just watch it.